Right. Thanks for being patient and waiting. We'll start out with making sure it's been properly noticed.
Yes, it has.
Thank you, and we'll call the meeting to order and have the Pledge of Allegiance. Please join me.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right, next item is recognitions, and I guess I'll start out with a recognition. As some of you may know, today is Take Your Child to Work Day, and so I brought with me my son, Bruce Woodbury. He is 9 years old in fourth grade. He still maintains that his grandpa is named after him, and he says maybe one day his grandpa can have a beltway named after him, too, if he does some good things. So, Bruce is, he told me this morning he wants to be a marine biologist or an oceanographer. So, I don't speak that language, but he can tell you anything about deep sea creatures that you want to know. And he got his Nevada citizen this year, which they had to name all their national and state representatives and local representatives. He knows everything about the state song and the motto and the state tree and all that kind of thing. And so you can quiz him on that as well. I told him that you guys are the most entertaining group in town, and so he's going to be grading each of you today on that. And then if you guys misbehave, he's my alternate, so he's going to take my place and put the meeting in order. So thanks for coming today, Bruce. We appreciate you being here. And I'll turn the time over to Dr. Iser.
Good morning, and I know Chairman Woodbury's, one of his favorite things is our updates every month from each one of the divisions, and I know that his other favorite thing each month is our recognitions, and I can tell you that this is also one of my favorite times. I'd like to ask Rosita Castillo to come forward. So we have prepared remarks, but as usual, prepared remarks aren't enough for people who step out of their usual boundaries and really go far beyond what they should or what they probably are expected to do to be able to promote health and dignity throughout our valley. And I think that we have one such person here today. Today we are continuing a Southern Nevada Health District tradition of presenting our annual Public Health Hero Award. A public health hero is an individual or organization nominated by our staff members, but outside of our own staff, whose contributions have an impact on our community's health and well-being. This year's recipient continues that tradition by encompassing one or more of the 10 essential functions of public health. This year, our public health hero is Rosita Castillo. Ms. Castillo is an active member of the Southern Nevada HIV Prevention Planning Group. She works for Planned Parenthood of Southern Nevada and serves as the Promotores de Salud Program Manager. The program trains community health workers in sexual health and sexual health resources. These individuals then provide education about these issues in individual or group settings, primarily in Spanish. And if I may, as an aside, Promotores aren't as commonly known here in Nevada as they are in Texas and California and other places, but I hope it's a profession that we see far more of in the future. She has worked in our community to build coalitions and partnerships to improve the health of Southern Nevadans, especially in the Latino-Latina community. Our sexual health clinic staff has worked with Ms. Castillo at local outreach events, and she has been a point of referral for sexual health clinic clients, especially those who are HIV positive. She is an excellent resource for those clients who are in need of medical assistance or resources which are out of the scope of normal services. This morning, I'm very pleased to present this award to Rosita Castillo for her continuing work in our community. Thank you.
You want to say a few words?
Yes. Good morning. It's an honor to be here today, and I am almost close to retirement. I don't think I'll ever retire. 3 years away, but this morning I want to thank everybody that's here, and I want to thank especially Cheryl and Brenda, you know, because we are together most, I think we spend more time, you know, each month, like the kids that spend a lot of time in school, we spend a lot of time together every month doing outreach and doing various things. But I also brought my daughter to work today. My pregnant daughter over there and her son, my grandson. I didn't know it was bring your kid to work day today. But I especially want to thank my daughter and my grandson. He doesn't understand what's going on. But many of the things that we do it on family time. I've been an advocate for HIV/AIDS prevention since the epidemic started in Washington, serving on various boards with the FQHC networks in Washington State. And a lot of it has been on my kids' times. I was telling Cheryl that the 4th of April was her birthday, and I felt guilty because I would have had a very important fair to attend, the foster parent health fair that happened out of town. And I started telling her there's going to be rights for Romero, and she said, when is the fair? I said, on your birthday. So she went along, and she had a lot of fun, and that's been part of my life. My daughters have grown up seeing, you know, my work with people that have no one else there for them when they're dying of AIDS. You know, they have seen my work with gang members. They have seen my work with women that are dying of cancer and nobody to visit them at the hospital. So I really don't feel that this is just for me. It's for all my promotores that are not here today, my volunteers, people like Brenda that just support me 100% in everything that I do. She says she has a hard time keeping up with me. I have so much energy that it's like I go like the bunny. But anyway, thank you very much, and it's an honor.
Thank you. Do you want to come up here? We'll get a picture together.
He's terrified of this building. As soon as I drove up, he said, am I going to get a shot? So he still thinks because we trick him to come here.
Aww.
Thank you, Papa. Mm-hmm. Send my chair with Abuela.
Like a shot, it's on the house. No charge, did it?
Thank you. That is, again, one of my favorite parts of all of these meetings, and I appreciated those remarks, too, about the family sacrifices that happen, and I know that's not unique to her, but, you know, what's done in the health district in these many different capacities is important, and we appreciate the families that make those sacrifices as well. Before we move on to, I also wanted to just publicly express our appreciation and condolences to Chris for the recent passing of her husband, and it's a tragedy that we all share. And just want to let you know we love and appreciate you, and encourage all of you to reach out to Chris and express that to her. We will move on to our first public comment period, which is items on the agenda or related to items on the agenda. Is there anyone wishing to speak? Thank you. Please state your name.
Thank you. That's Dr. Victoria Harding. And I am the vice president of the union here for the general unit and an employee here. So I would just like to talk about the fees that we're changing in environmental health that's on the agenda for today. A lot of this is just a question, and maybe Annette can actually, when you guys talk about it, actually explain this a little bit better. I'm trying to understand the difference between fees that are approved through the Board of Health and fees that just change not through the Board of Health. And what is, because on the bylaws it says that all of these fees are changed, approved through the Board of Health. In the NRS, it states that it's fees for permits or licensure. So, you know, I don't know, but we did have a fee just change beginning of August or beginning of April that was our sexual health clinic fee. And it's not a big change or anything. It's not anything that I'm worried about. I'm just trying to get when things are changed with the Board of Health approval and when it's not. The other thing was, from my understanding, we're going to be taking on some state and maybe Nye County of doing some environmental health work for them. And I'm wondering if this fee structure is also going to be working for them as well. Because from my understanding is their fee structures are very different. And basically what they charge, we couldn't go out there and do basically that job without putting in 80-10 money. And as a taxpayer and somebody who pays taxes, I'm not so certain I would be happy with my taxpayer money going out to service Nye County if we had to fund that with 80-10 money. And then lastly, you know, I come up here and I speak, you know, pretty much every month. You can tell this bothers me every time I come up here because I am not a public speaker at all. This is pure torture for me. And I don't really have anything negative to say or anything. I don't care what people say about my coming up here. But yesterday some people went around and asked other members, other employees, whether they were going to come up here and speak to the board today. I found that to be actually inappropriate at best and fairly intimidating at its worst. And I just hope that that would never happen again, that anybody would survey whether anybody was going to come up here and speak. Thank you. That's it.
Thank you. And as to the fees, perhaps we could address that at some point in the future directly with Victoria. Is there anyone else wishing to speak from the public? Okay, we'll close the public comment and move to adoption of today's agenda. Do we have any changes?
Don't move.
Got a motion to adopt?
Okay.
And a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? And that motion carries. We'll move to the consent agenda, which only includes approval of the
move for approval
minutes of the March 23rd meeting. We have a motion.
Second.
And a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. We correct it.
Any opposed?
Can the record show with one abstention since I wasn't here at the last meeting? To
yes.
Make okay. That two. I wasn't here last month either.
Okay. All right. We'll move to then to Roman numeral four, public hearing action items. And our first item there is memorandum number 04-15, consider adopt proposed Southern Nevada Health District Environmental Health District event coordinator fee schedule.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Jackie Rezitar, Director of Environmental Health, and this morning I'd like the board to consider adopting the proposed fee schedule modification for event coordinator permits. To clarify, an event coordinator is a designated person or the person assigned by the event sponsor who is responsible for the coordination of the food vendors and health-related services at special events, such as Eldorado Brews and Blues and NASCAR. This is a layer of management to protect public health. In early spring of 2014, Environmental Health was asked to conduct a study to consider lowering event coordinator fees for smaller events taking place at Horseman's Park. I must acknowledge the hard work put forth by EH food op staff in preparing a cost analysis fully supporting the reduction of event coordinator fees for smaller events. In addition, per request during the March Board of Health meeting, Herb Sequeira and Larry Rogers, supervisors of the 2014 and 2015 NASCAR event, are prepared to provide an overall cost analysis and fiscal impact of fees if reduced for larger events. I'll now turn to Rose to review the fee schedule modification for small, medium, and large events, followed by Larry Rogers and Herb Sequeira for review of NASCAR's fiscal impact.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, board members, and Bruce. Just to recap what we discussed last month, I know a couple of the board members were not present. In March, we are proposing to modify what is now currently a one-size-fits-all, in that all event coordinators, whether it's a very small event or whether it is a mega event, pay an event coordinator application fee of $290. We did do an extensive cost analysis of representative events, since we do hundreds of events every year, looking at the small category, the medium category, and then the larger events. And we did look at worst-case scenario with our smaller events to make sure that with the proposed fee reduction from $290 to $145 for these smaller events, we would still cover the cost of our doing business with the permit fees, both that the temporary food establishment operators pay and also the event coordinator pays. And we feel confident that in the vast majority of cases, reducing that fee to $145 will still cover our cost of business in pre-event planning and in the actual inspection process in the field to assure public safety and health. For the medium events, we are proposing no fee change. We want to keep that at $290. And again, in the vast majority of cases, that's going to cover our cost of doing business. There are a handful of large events that have a very large infrastructure and take a great deal of event planning that it does tend to have some significant cost overruns. We did do a cost analysis of both small, medium, and large events, which is available, and we'd be happy to answer any questions which you have. I know that there were questions specific to NASCAR, so I am now going to introduce Mr. Larry Rogers and Mr. Herb Sequeira, who are two of my five supervisors with the Food Operations Program. Mr. Rogers' office was lead with the 2014 NASCAR, and Mr. Sequeira's office was lead for the 2015 NASCAR. Thank you very much.
Good morning, all. My name is Herb Sequeira, and I'll let Larry Rogers go ahead and do the 2014 NASCAR cost analysis, and then I'll follow up with the 2015.
Good morning. I'm Larry Rogers. I'm the supervisor of the downtown office and was responsible for NASCAR in 2014. Just a quick overview. NASCAR, of course, is one of our larger events. It is the largest sporting event between the Pacific Ocean and the Mississippi, I've been told. It's larger than the Rose Bowl, so it is a significant event. In 2014, we collected $21,000 in revenue, but our overall cost was $33,000. So that represented an $11,000 loss for the district. That's significant because that particular NASCAR is arguably one of our most efficient. I had a very experienced lead inspector who I think it was her third time actually being the liaison and coordinator of that particular event. And I think she's done NASCAR actually every year that she's been here. I also had a veteran staff that year. Everyone who participated in that NASCAR event had done it before. And then I also had some inspectors who would work on Friday and then Saturday, so there wasn't any loss of efficiency. So that $11,000 loss is quite, that's probably the best we can do at the NASCAR event under our current event coordinator fee situation. And I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Sequeira, who can explain the circumstances this year.
Well, right off the bat, I'm going to go ahead and, as you see the cost analysis in front, our total net loss shows a $17,000 net loss in comparison to last year. The significant difference that occurred this year versus last year was that this year we went ahead and used different crews every day, mandated by our over-adjusted work schedule requirement. We didn't use any overtime per se at the actual event. Also, the person in charge was not a seasoned inspector in coordinating these type of activities. Although she's a seasoned inspector, this was the first time she took on a mega event. Of course, there was coordination done between the prior PIC person in charge and the person that went ahead and assumed the responsibility this year. Other factors that went into play was that we didn't have as many vendors. Okay, we had a difference of 20 vendors. But where we came in with a difference was that this year we used different teams every other day because I couldn't use the same staff. As Larry explained, he used an efficient staff. My staff was efficient, but they had to go out there and learn the land every single day. So there was a difference. Also, the difference that we found this year was that the coordination between the person in charge out at NASCAR and our schedule that we had didn't marry up all the time when we were out there. So there was some significant time differences with our inspectors going to a facility to inspect, but they weren't ready for us. You know, so we ran across some issues associated with that. Then we went ahead. This year we had the privilege of training new inspectors. So this was an opportunity for Environmental Health to take the new inspectors out there so they can be introduced to the surrounding area of what they're going to be exposed to in future activities. So we showed a $17,000 loss, but if we didn't go ahead and take the trainers out there, it would have showed a less of a loss of approximately $5,000. And we had to go ahead and kick up our surveillance because on day one we found some issues. So on Saturday we went ahead and repeated going to several outlets to see if they had the proper equipment and the proper knowledge to go ahead and handle food safely. Also, we followed that on day three. So that's why there was a significant increase in costs. You know, now we had surveillance that we did. We did longer surveillance, and we had additional personnel. But we didn't go ahead and hit into the overtime area because of our new contract, and we followed that very closely.
Thank you.
I would just open it up for questions about these two particular events or the overall fee structure.
Chris.
Thank you very much. When you use the term surveillance, if the event has been permitted, why are we surveilling people?
Okay. We go out there and perform surveillance because we've been noticing that not that the operators are bad, but some of them lack the education to go ahead and properly do it. And in those events, there's a lot of change out of personnel, not the person that owns the particular establishment that's permitted there, but the personnel that are cooking. It's a very active type of event, so they change out a lot of people. The people that we see on day one may not be the same people that we see on day two and day three where we had a problem. And the area is broken up into three different areas that we have to go ahead and view. And we had some challenging customers, not because of their resistance to what we wanted them to do. It was the problems with equipment, problems with personnel, not washing their hands right, not having temperature instrumentation to go ahead and serve the food properly, making sure that it's cooked properly and all of that. So we did have to go ahead and pay extra attention to that.
So let me understand this better. When you require an event coordinator and you require an upfront meeting with whoever is applying, would that not be the time where you got the list of who's been approved, who's going to be on site, and if there's training that needs to happen, that was the purpose of the initial meeting, rather than going back out afterwards to try to catch people doing whatever it is they may be doing?
Well, we're not trying to catch anybody. What we're trying to do is make sure they're serving food safely. And yes, the initial point of contact, the initial conversations, we do express all the requirements that the operators have to have. In these type of mega events, things do fall through the crack on the other side of the fence, not on environmental health. We're trying to go ahead and educate them as we're inspecting them too, because a lot of times, a lot of these customers come from out of state. So we don't really get to see them until the day that we approve their permit. Okay, a lot of them mail in their permits, and they mail in the billing for it. And we never see them until we go out there and actually perform the inspection.
So because you do an overall permit for the event, so whether it's NASCAR, Electric Daisy, Foodie Fest, any of those types of things, you don't really know. So what are we permitting then?
When we go, we don't permit them. They go ahead and get a permit that we go ahead and approve based upon them passing an inspection. That inspection occurs when the physical activity occurs, when we're on site. They don't have a permit until we approve it. They pay for the permit, they have it, but it's not approved until one of our inspectors actually perform a physical inspection.
Okay, so then when you go do that part, who pays? You're saying you lost $11,000. You don't charge them for those inspection times then?
The inspection time is paid with their inspection application. When they pay their permit fee, that they're paying for their inspection, that one-time inspection. They're not paying for a follow-up. We're doing the follow-up to go ahead and make sure that the public is being served safely. Now, when we do see a problem, we don't approve it. Or during the surveillance, if there's a problem, we stop the operation, we correct the problem, we stay there to make sure that they can get back into operation, because we don't want to hold anybody up from their business operation. But we will interfere if there's a public health issue.
And that's the $290 that you charge for the mega event.
The $290 is the fee that an event coordinator pays right now. Okay. And that's just for the event coordinator.
Okay, and then what would that business in that circumstance then pay?
Well, normally with the $290 would deal with the infrastructure of the facility. Are the bathrooms taken care of? Is there a location for deposit of wastewater? Is there trash collection? If they're going to go ahead and use a commissary type to keep their food cold for
the whole event.
Operators, you know, that's what that $290.
Then what else do you charge then once?
The other things that we charge for is for each separate permit that we call a temporary facility event, okay? And we go ahead, and depending upon the length of time that the event is occurring, we have different types of fees. If it's a 1 to 5 day, it's $131. And if they come in and they pay late, there's associated late fees that are with that.
And that's per group. So if you had 10 foodie trucks or whatever, or you're at Petapalooza and you've got this different grouping, that each one of those pay that additional fee.
Yes, ma'am.
And I do want to thank the board for letting me have another subsequent meeting, and I was in the middle of sending out notes, and my husband was killed, so I didn't do that. But some of the concerns that came in was that, and I think it's something that Councilman Beers raised last time, is that we didn't have a cap on the end, and that we probably should be discussing that part one. Some of the smaller businesses that came to the meeting, I had about 27 businesses that showed up, we're concerned that we don't allow for bundling. So, for example, if you're an ice cream truck and you've got 10 of them and it's exactly the same food that you or ice cream that you sell at everything, they have to pay each time?
Yes, ma'am.
And the reason that gets for a little costly for small business, especially if it's the same product.
And I do understand that, and Rose went ahead and addressed that in identifying that she is proposing that smaller events receive a lesser amount on their permit fee.
But they pay five times if they have five ice cream trucks. That was their issue that was raised. I think the board should take into consideration.
Ma'am,
the bundling isn't permitted, supposedly. If you want to clarify or correct me, I'm fine with that.
But
It can be very complex with the type of permitting options that are open. A number of the ice cream trucks, actually, they would not pay an additional temporary food establishment fee. If they have an annual permit on their truck, they don't pay additional fees as long as they stay within the infrastructure of their truck. The event coordinator does put them on the application so that we're aware that they're there. And we might visit them briefly just to see that, you know, everything is up to standards. But they, if it is, in fact, an ice cream truck that is permitted to, you know, drive around the neighborhoods and so on, they can attend these special events without additional fees.
Okay. It was Kona Ice that had brought the issue, so they're not a traditional ice cream truck, and their concern as a small business was that they're having to have the event coordinator for a meeting for each one. Then you had to pay for each truck, even though it was exactly the same product.
And I understand that what you're saying. Yes.
And that may not be necessarily addressed in this, but I do believe the cap that I heard from both gaming had a concern that we didn't have a cap on the top end. Mm-hmm. Because if you have an event, they go out, you think it's going to cost you $10,000, and then all of a sudden you get a bill for $18,000, that becomes an issue to them as far as that's concerned. I know that that was raised before. I have other questions, but I'll see if others have anything else. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Anita.
All right. I wasn't here last meeting, so I guess I need to be brought up to speed a little bit. My big concern about your presentation, and I guess maybe that's where CAPS may help, is I get that you want the district to be able to recoup the expense that, you know, for the man hours that we're putting into this, we need to recoup enough money to cover that. And I get that, and I support that. But obviously, there was a big difference in personnel and how things were handled. I'm sorry, 2014 versus 15?
Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am.
So part of me, as I was sitting there listening to you, is saying, okay, I want to make sure everybody gets recouped for their expense, but whose responsibility should it be if there's a difference, as you said, in training of the personnel, or if we aren't necessarily able to use the same people every day? Is that a cost that needs to be passed on to the – and maybe that's where, like I said, CAP may come in and help with that. Because I'm not sure that they necessarily should be charged because we couldn't use the same people every day, or that maybe we didn't have as experienced people in 2015 available to do that particular event as we had in 2014. So, I mean, I want to make sure that we recoup the costs that are legitimately, you know, that should be borne by the I don't know, promoter or what term you want to use, the event people, but or promoters or, yeah, whatever. But I also want to make sure that we're not passing on costs maybe that shouldn't go back to them. So
understood. Do you wish to make any comment?
No.
Dr. Eisner, do you wish to make any comments sir, with regard to that? Okay.
No.
Okay, sir.
I guess thank you. They're asking me if I wanted to make a comment, and I guess the only comment that goes through my mind as I hear you talk about this is that we have turnover, especially in environmental health. People come in very young. No longer do people come in expecting to stay, and I'm looking at you because you asked the question, so it's addressing the whole board. But people don't stay very long, and we do have turnover of staff, actually a fairly significant turnover of staff. So we can't guarantee that the staff who was here when Larry was in charge will be the same staff as when Herb is in charge. And indeed, you need to continue to train people. And so part of that is what increased the cost. And I heard you say, Herb, that some of the cost, I don't know how much, I think you said maybe $5,000, was due to the fact that for some reason the event coordinator at NASCAR wasn't there or the actual vendors weren't there when you needed them to be there to be able to meet with them. So you have to come back out to be able to do that. So some of those costs are clearly not environmental health's fault, if there's a fault.
For lack of a better word.
Does that help to answer your question, perhaps?
Oh, absolutely. And I'm not saying that there were not legitimate reasons for the difference in costs. But I am saying, as much as you want, I mean, should the vendors be responsible for the training, or is that a cost that should fall to us? I just think it needs to be looked at.
And the costs of training are really throughout the whole division. So every fee every person who pays a fee wherever else helps to pay for those training costs anyway, since we have to continually have, you know, we have a training unit now, a standardization unit, that's trying to standardize all of our frontline inspectors to be able to go out and if they come to your facility or your facility, that they'll come there and do, hopefully, if both came at the same day and didn't know about each other, that they would come up with the same findings. And that's what we need to do, and that's how we do it, is through through a small amount of the fee that we charge everyone.
I do have a question, and that is that it seems a bit of overkill if you've permitted the event and you've permitted the vendors, and then we keep rechecking them over and over again. Shouldn't they have their proof from wherever they are that they have passed their health inspections, they have food handlers' cards, you know? I mean, why do we keep rechecking these people? And if they make somebody sick, that should be their responsibility.
If I may try this one, and then I'll turn it back over to you, is that at an event this size where, and you've been to them, I'm sure you eat at more than one, if there is an outbreak, it's oftentimes very difficult to trace it back to an individual vendor. And I think it's very rare that an individual patient who gets sick actually sues a vendor. And I, you weren't here last month, but I explained that at a barbecue cook-off up in Reno, I went to that the evening before, and then I went back the morning after, and they had stored their pre-cooked foods incorrectly, and we had to get the owner of the gaming establishment to intervene to make them throw out that food, which we did test and was contaminated by bacteria. So when you may hope, and again, you asked the question, so I'm looking at you.
Right, that's
so
fine.
You may hope that a vendor knows what they're doing. Oftentimes there are lapses, and those lapses, if they're not recognized, can cause disease. And if they are recognized, even by themselves, are expensive for them. So we do try to do that training on site. In this particular case, we talked to them about how to properly store the food overnight so it would cool down sufficiently. Those people who know about restaurants know what I'm talking about for pre-cooked food, so that bacterial growth doesn't occur. And there would have been, had I actually not intervened and called the one of the owner-operators of the casino to go out there and intervene, there would have been illness, I could almost guarantee you. I can't remember the name of the bacteria that grew, but they were pathogenic bacteria.
I guess I understand that. What I'm saying is that oftentimes when you have smaller events like we have in Mesquite, sometimes it's really hard to get vendors in because they feel very over-regulated, and it becomes an issue when they've already passed all of their inspections, they've, you know, got their permits and everything, and when things are hosted by the casinos, normally that falls on them and they take care of things. I don't think we've really had an issue. I'm just saying that sometimes it feels like it's overkill.
One of the things which we've tried to do is that we have extensive educational information, and our staff, as soon as we get an application in, staff do at least make a phone call to even individual vendors to review just the basic food safety. It's a one-page quick reference checklist. It basically covers the five foodborne illness risk factors which we want to have controlled at these events so that they're very successful at their event and they're serving safe food. So that we try to do where with these transient events, they don't go through the food handler program that regularly permitted locations do. We try to do everything possible through setting up a bit of a rapport with that operator even before the day of the event to give them the tools they need.
Many of these people, as Rose points out, come from out of state, so they don't have an opportunity, and we don't require them to get a food handler card for temporary events like this.
Right, but they have some credentials from wherever they came from.
They may or may not.
We don't require them to show us
their... No, they may or may not have credentials. And especially on temporary food facilities. So for this barbecue event up north, they came from major places in my hometown of Kansas City, where barbecue is king, to Tennessee and other places. And so they don't know necessarily our regulations, which are often better conformed to good public health practice than in other places.
You can come to Mesquite next weekend to see if whether or not Kansas City is king. We have a big barbecue event.
Well, I'll take you, if you join me to Kansas City, and I'll take you to Joe's, which is my favorite barbecue restaurant.
I have grandkids in Kansas City. It's a deal.
Okay.
Follow-up questions, if there's no other.
Anybody else?
Tim does.
Tim?
I would just say that if you can clearly identify what is a training cost, a field training cost, maybe that's a cost that ought to not come back to post-event. Certainly there ought to be field training, and it's a necessary thing to bring up the professionalism. But if you could clearly identify it as a training cost, I would hope that that would not come back to be a follow-up cost to the event.
Well, my point of identifying the training cost was to show you why we had a significant increase in it. But if we remove that training cost, and we wouldn't pass that on to the client, that's an in-house training cost to us. Our actual cost would be $10,000 of a loss, okay?
And what?
And we remove the surveillance, but surveillance is important.
And what was, once again, what was the total revenue for the event?
The total revenue for the event was $17,900.
And it, without the training, if you remove the training, it would have been $27,000?
Yeah, if I remove the training, it would have been $10,000 loss.
And in speaking, I guess you probably have not had a discussion with NASCAR because this is not yet in effect, but had they had any comment as to what that would do to their event or any issues with the event?
We haven't communicated that with the bigger facilities yet. We wanted to go ahead and see how things would roll in regards to how it's going to affect the small event operators, how much we go ahead and significantly spend with the big operators. And Rose has developed a scenario where the bigger events wouldn't actually go ahead and be charged an increase in their event coordinator fee. What they would be charged was what we spend above and beyond what we took in for revenue.
Let me just ask a question from a different perspective. The numbers are circling in my head. The total revenue, once again, was?
$17,900.
And you would have needed to charge them an additional $10,000 to break even?
To break even.
Could you think that you might live with the health district with setting a ceiling of no more than 50% additional cost on an event? So if they had $10,000 of revenue, you're not going to come back to them with more than a $5,000 extra cost?
Well, I mean, we wouldn't be recouping our cost then, which was the, I thought the point of this was that in order to give the smaller operations a break, because essentially what we have now is our mom and pops, our small business owners, paying for NASCAR, Electric Daisy Carnival, Life is Beautiful. I mean, those are multi-million dollar events, and we've got our mom and pops paying their portion of that. And I thought the purpose of this was to accurately assess our operators, you know, what it costs us. And if it costs us $10,000 and we're only charging $5,000, we're still losing $5,000.
I get that. But at the same time, they've got to run a business and they've got to be able to project what it's going to cost. Mm-hmm. And certainly they should be held accountable for having quality people operating their temporary food events. But they still need to have a guidance as to what would be the ultimate cost for them.
One of the things that I really hope would come out of this is that if they know that if they're doing a very good job and they're organized, we do have some of these large events that are on that last page that actually paid for themselves. There were various reasons why they didn't have these significant overages. We could go into a great deal of detail, but my hope is that if there is an after-the-fact fee, as we mentioned last month, we will keep track of how much has went into this event. We will be in contact with those event coordinators. But if they're doing a good job, then if everything's on time, then we're spending less time at their event. They're doing their job versus we are having to compensate for their not having done the job maybe as effectively as they could. So that we spend a lot of time with dialogue with these very large event coordinators. And it may be an incentive to do more planning have more educated individuals in food safety out there. And I think it will really make these events safer because everyone will have the incentive. We don't want them to have to spend extra money. We just want them to have everything put together in a way that they're going to serve safe food and have a safe event for the public.
All right, Chris, then Mary Beth.
Oh, go to Mary Beth first. I talk.
Okay.
Well, actually, kind of addressed what I was going to ask, because I noticed in the public workshop that was one of the concerns, was budgeting for the permits and not knowing ahead of time really what they were going to budget. And so if we had kind of a scale where this is the basic cost, but it could go up to this amount so they could budget, but that would be an incentive for them to have all their ducks in a row to reduce their costs.
And if I may, it seems like with the data that you all have put together, in particular looking at NASCAR, they're only, what, those five other events, but two are foodie fests.
Yeah, foodie fests.
And they break even. So they're not a problem. But if we know the historical cost overruns for the last two or three years, we could give them that estimate that it would be in this range historically by your own by the inspections that we had to do at your particular festival. I think we can do that.
Thank you. Let me just take a step back. Everybody has to have an event coordinator, regardless of the size.
No, ma'am. And
just so clarify
I know
that, because
it
got confusing for some folks that weren't here. So only the larger megas require the event coordinator.
No, ma'am. Actually, if there's multiple vendors, even with the small events, if there's more than one vendor, there needs to be an event coordinator, because if it's just a single vendor, they're basically coordinating themselves.
Right.
They are getting a permission letter to be on whatever property they're going to hold the event. They're getting all their use permits and so on.
So the
but
fee,
if there's the, okay. multiple vendors.
Okay, so
yes.
Rose, when I go to your thing, for your fee,
yes.
you're cutting the fee in half for the event coordinator?
Yes, ma'am. That would be for any event
okay.
that has
then
two
Then why
to
would
ten.
We not hold them liable for any problems, number one? Number two, in order to help the smalls, we kept the larger megas at the same dollar amount, and maybe that's not reflective of what really the cost should be, and then you don't need to have back charging that comes in, because that was the concern from the businesses that I heard from, and several of us did, is you don't want to have that continually ratchet up. You think you budgeted $18,000 and it becomes $26,000 afterwards. It may not sound like a huge number, but maybe the flaw, with no disrespect, is why did we keep that at $290? If the actual cost for the event is $322, then that's what it should be, and then we don't ratchet it up because we make a decision that we want to do OJT. We want to make sure that we're surveilling people. How many get sent out? Just because we can send out 15 inspectors to surveil, that is intrusive, let alone costly. So there's just a balancing act that I think still needs to be flushed out. I appreciate helping the smalls, but again, it's if they have to pay for the event coordinator, then the permit, then each individual permit, then it can escalate. I think Tim has a good idea of some kind of cap that needs to be there so there's an expectation that the businesses know that it won't ever exceed this amount. And maybe we look at the event coordinator being the they have to post a bond or something. I mean, you know, there's just different ways to look at it without over-regulating people in the long run. Gentleman said that you took out inspectors to educate them about the code, correct? And to kind of, you're on...
We took out inspectors
right.
to educate them with the environment.
Yeah, because you're going to need some on-site. So much of what you do is subjective. I hear from more businesses of my inspector says, you know, it's been fine for 15 years. I get a new set of eyes, and they tell me I'm written up. And I don't think that's appropriate, and that's something to talk about for another day. But when you're training your inspectors, are you training them to the 2010 code that's on the books, or are you doing the 2013 that's being reviewed, not in a public workshop yet, but that is being worked on?
We are basically using the same criteria as Chapter 15 of the current regulations. And one of the reasons why we did look at how many trainees went out, how much the surveillance costs were, because we wanted to bring all that information in a very transparent way to the board. Mm-hmm. Those are the things that if we were having to keep track of how much additional time over just that base $290 fee, those would be considerations, of course, and that's why we wanted to break it down a little bit, why this year was more than last year, because we did take the opportunity to train staff. We wanted to let the board know that. If we were charging someone an after-the-fact fee, would those be considerations? Those are things which probably, if we're training staff, they would not incur those charges. One other additional thing which I'd like to say is why we wanted to keep the base fee or the application fee the same as it is, the $290, is that those operators of larger events that basically through the temporary food establishment fee, which is put in place because the individual vendors do pull their own permits and they have responsibility for their food safety, that if with those fees plus just that base fee, which it already is, covers the cost, we don't want them to incur additional cost. We would rather keep the cost as low as possible. That's why we brought forward this type
then
of
I
business
think
plan.
At least with Tim's idea of some sort of a cap percentage on the back end so you don't get hit with the back charging, and then maybe a one-year review to see what's happened and how it's affected businesses. We need to regulate. We need to be safe. Food should be safe. But we don't need to over-regulate, and we tend to do that in this community no matter what. So maybe that's the balancing act that comes in. And then when you start your public workshops, I think there needs to be a greater outreach, because none of my off-strip people even knew there were conversations going on. So I think we shouldn't just look at, oh, it's the large gaming properties. There's impacts on everybody, but that's for the actual workshop component coming up down the road. So I don't know. I throw that out there, Mr. Chair, as a possibility if the board wants to move forward with the fee structure of some kind of a cap so we don't back charge, and then a reasonable approach to how many people we send out to surveil after we've permitted them. It just still doesn't make sense in my mind. But.
Thank you. John.
Let's just take an upcoming event so I can understand this process. It would seem to me that we've had enough events in this market over the last number of years that we'd be able to forecast. Let's take Rock in Rio, which will be two weekends, maybe 80,000 people a day. Do we know how many vendors they're going to have at Rock in Rio at this point in time?
We have been in contact and had meetings with the prospective event coordinator. In this particular instance, where this is an inaugural event, there are a number of thoughts as far as outside vendors. Even before the event coordinator has made application, we've been in contact with them and reaching out to them.
Hey, this is
and they still don't have their list of vendors to us in its totality, so that we're continually asking them to have the vendors come in. And it's to the point now where the event coordinator is even thinking of those vendors which don't have an understanding that they will make application, and they're actively working with us with the pre-event planning to assure that we get all those applications in. But with this first inaugural of this particular type of event, there's a lot of work that will be going on at the last minute to get this together, because they've been hesitant in getting into us. We've been reaching out a great deal.
Okay, let me rephrase the question.
Certainly.
If we knew there were 100 vendors there, at this event, wouldn't we be able to forecast based on prior experience what the cost to the health district is going to be for that event?
I could give you an example. Many of you may know that the last two falls we've had an event in the downtown area, Life is Beautiful. The first year, there was a bit of disorganization, but there was a lot of lessons learned. The event coordinator actually started having contact with us for the second year much sooner than they did previously. There was a great deal more organization, and even though it was something like 18 city blocks and we had very, very limited parking, there was less of a cost override this year versus the first year. So for most of these events, NASCAR being a bit of a of a different one for the reasons we had indicated. Everything was accomplished much more expediently and, with Life is Beautiful during year two versus year one. The first year of events, it is more difficult to forecast because we have the variables of not knowing what the event coordinator's knowledge is and their level of organization. Typically, when you have subsequent events, more things are put in place and they're more organized.
If I may, and I don't mean to stop any discussion, but let me make a proposal that you all move and second and approve this fee structure with this third page with the huge cost overruns be limited for this year to $7,000 so that every vendor on this list would know that they would pay no more than that over, and then we'll come back to you if that's way under. Come back to you next year with a report at least, and maybe with a recommendation to increase that or decrease it if we find that everyone is doing better.
Just a clarification of your proposal. You're proposing just these events that are on the list or any new events that come in, so, such as Rock and Rio?
Yeah, the new events as well. I would agree with, I'm sorry, I would say that the large events under the definition of large event would still have that cost overrun of no more than $7,000.
Maybe just for perspective, Rose, I think you've given us this, the total number of events in the course of a year and how many of these are the 60...
Yes, I'd be happy to.
60 TFEs or more.
Mr. Jones, I'd be happy to do so. That was part of the analysis, and we used data from the whole calendar year of 2014. And one thing about Rock and Rio, which is going to be of a real advantage to them, where I believe, Dr. Iser, you said that we're not going to start these fees until July 1, so we can notify everyone, educate everyone regarding it. Rock and Rio is in May. And we will be doing a cost analysis so that we will know how much it cost us versus what the permit fees were that came in. And then we can do a debrief with the event coordinator after the fact, and then they'll know what potential cost overrides, or possibly it'll just be an even break where the cost, the revenue took care of the cost. But we will do a cost analysis of Rock and Rio. It's not going to cost them anything additional over just the $290 plus the temporary food establishment vendors paying their application fees, and we'll share that information with them.
You may know more than me at this point. I'm not sure that they're even going to have 60 vendors.
They may not even reach 60.
So they would.
We don't know at this point because the applications are slow to come in this year.
Which is only $290 anyway.
And there's no back charges in the middle range.
No. So not at the current time, no, and not with this proposal.
How many total events and how many of them are large?
At this point in time for 2014, we had five.
Five large out of how many total events?
Out of 297. Which, you know, if you do look at that first page of that cost analysis, for 2014, there were 297 special events that were the traditional special events. And 201 of those are the small events, and we don't want them to pay any more than the time it takes us to inspect. We will be seeing a deficit of over $29,000, but this is the fair thing to do with these smaller events. We don't want to over-regulate them. We've tried to really simplify the process. We do a great deal of pre-event planning, even if it is a smaller event, to help them organize it so the public stays safe.
So only five out of 297 face this risk.
Yes.
And if we go with the proposal from Dr. Iser, there would be no more than a $7,000 risk for them on the back charge end.
Yes, sir.
With the possible addition of Rocking Rio next year.
Right. Well,
but we'll let them know how things go this year and do a debrief with them. I'll guarantee
to
that.
Under 60 vendors if you were playing the game.
That's correct.
Just a question. What does the 7,000 equate to percentage-wise in your mind? I'm trying to look at the numbers to see where it
I
came
didn't
with.
Look at a percentage, as Mr. Jones suggested. What I did look is at the cost overruns, and it's approximately half of the cost overruns.
I look at
for
the total expense column. Is that
yeah?
What
if you look
at
the net gain or loss in the red, for NASCAR 2014. It was about 12. Then we made $565 on.
Can I just clarify one thing real quick? On our hard handouts, we only have the medium. If you look on the
right.
Oh.
So the large, I think, is what you're talking about.
I'm talking about the large
ones. That's thank you. That's where I was going because I was like I wasn't.
It is on your iPad. So I'll read that to you. So for 2014, not counting this year's NASCAR, there were five events. NASCAR was a loss of 12. Foodie Fest was a gain of $500. Electric Daisy was a loss of 14,000. I'm rounding off just so you're sure. Foodie Fest was a gain of 2,500, and then Life is Beautiful was a loss of $1,600. So what I did was just take these and come up with a thing that wouldn't impact us as seriously as if we didn't add this additional fee on, but give everyone a goal to try to bring it in under so that we can save them that
money.
So
the back charge would not impact any size then, medium, large, and small?
Well, all I'm talking about is the large. Because there isn't a back charge for the medium and
the
small.
Or the small.
But you see, we do lose money on both, on some small and medium.
Small and medium.
And which column does the proposed $7,000 cap apply to?
On the large event analysis, if you go over to the far right, it's in red.
We don't have that. It's not on my
screen. It's not, I can't find it on the screen.
It's on the iPad.
It's only electronic. We don't have it in the hard handout.
What's this? Okay. Who would like to have a hard copy of the last page? Please. It's, I think, three, but take them all just in case. Leo's or Jackie's trying to bring it up on the screen, but it may be very difficult to see. You can expand it so we only see that last column. Yes, that's it. I don't know if you all can see that. I can see it here. And you all can see it either on the left side, which is a bigger screen, or on the straight ahead. So, again, I just read through the red column, that entire column, and that's why I said 7,000. We still would lose money, but I think be a reasonable way to go forward.
That's your net gain or loss. What number? What's the $7,000 number?
I just made it up.
But what's the cap? What's cap are we talking about? So that if I'm the vendor, I know what you're talking about.
So we can give this chart to them to show that NASCAR that we lost about $12,000, and we'll say next year we're implementing this new fee schedule, but there'll be a cap of no more than $7,000 loss. I mean, $7,000 that you would have to pay in addition to your regular fees. That's the cap. It's the cap on the after charge.
So currently we're charging them this $12,000?
No. So are those the late? Are those the late columns? That's I'm
no,
just
that's
trying
just
to
the overall loss for each one of these individual five events, these five large events that happened in 2014.
Okay, so up front they pay
$290.
They pay a base fee up front.
Correct.
For both the temporary permits as well as the event coordinator.
Well, the temporary events are per vendor, so there's no way for us to determine in advance necessarily how many will be there and how many may pull out at the last minute and so on. But we're talking about just the event coordinator, the organization that's coordinating. It would be the event coordinator fee of $290 plus no more than $7,000 in fee overrun or in cost overrun.
Could I take
the 118 or the 177? Because, see, I don't think we've even talked about that part of it. So where?
The total loss.
But the loss was tied to the job training or to the surveillance?
This one wasn't even this was tied to surveillance but not job training. This was in 2014, which was Larry's event.
And I don't think the business should have to pay for us making a choice to surveil people with a great number of employees if we've already permitted them.
We have to do that. That's the point, I think, that we're trying to express here. Without surveillance, there would have been sick people at the event I talked to you about, actually, but in Sparks. We have to do surveillance.
If we do surveillance, then maybe it's one person. You don't need – how many do we send out? Because
depends
they're getting
on the size
dinged
of the event.
Because I look at the EH time, that's 106, whatever that equates to. And none of it's overtime because the union negotiated away the overtime. So
that was overtime in 2014. That did include overtime.
The 106 is not overtime. That was on a Friday. The 68.9 was not an overtime, and then that 106 was overtime, reflecting the increased costs.
What finance currently gives us as far as just regular time is $118 an hour. And then the 177 is at time and a half. So for the NASCAR of this year, you're going to see very minimal overtime because we made every possible use of the mandatory adjusted work week. But we still have to cover the hourly cost at regular time. And we did do a breakout, if you could possibly go back to page 2 of the cost analysis, which will give you a breakdown of each day with the 2015 NASCAR. You might find that useful. And then it also broke out how many total hours of surveillance. And we only had, Herb, how many people actually did surveillance with the total having been 19 hours?
The surveillance was a total of 5 people that performed.
So for the NASCAR event on that day, to go over that very large footprint, there were 5 people that were doing quick checks throughout the area of the speedway.
There were 5 people reinspecting 152.
There were 5 people out there. There were some inspections that were performed because they could not be performed on Saturdays or Friday because they were not set up. So we did normal inspections out there because it was the first time we got to see them.
That I understand.
Okay. And mm-hmm. then there were several other people that were out there doing surveillance.
We tried
I
to break it down by day there.
I took a total of 5 people out there on Sunday to go ahead and perform surveillance and inspections. So that we spend a total time of 22.5 hours doing surveillance.
Have we always done surveillance?
We've been doing surveillance since last year.
Okay, yes. It's a new thing. I, as a board member, knew, and maybe it's the term, but it offends me that I'm being surveilled once I've been inspected. I completely agree with you that if you didn't have the chance to inspect them because they hadn't been set up yet, completely agree with that part. But I think maybe a policy change may have come into play that we weren't aware of, that maybe that's what the businesses were telling me. And I'm like, I didn't even know what they were talking about. I didn't even know they had to submit recipes to you guys to have to have approval, for heaven's sake. So
there's only certain things with special processes that they may have to do that. But I certainly hear what you're saying. And it is something that was added on as just an additional public health measure. How much or how little we do of it, ultimately, once we see that their infrastructure is sound, that they show knowledge during their initial permitting inspection, really the onus is on them to continue in that safe manner throughout the service to the public. The surveillance is an extra safeguard to ensure that people are doing that. But I do agree, once they have a permit approved, the onus should be that with everything they put in place and that the inspector has seen it and it meets standard, it is very hopeful that they practice food safety ethics and they continue
and
to operate that way.
Because
we can't look over their shoulders with hundreds of these vendors during the whole extent of the event. Surveillance is doing a quick walk by and see if we're seeing people handle ready to eat food with bare hands.
Right, I understand
if food's
that,
being left out.
I have
out.
To say, Rose, I didn't know we surveilled people, and that's a policy that I think this board should have been aware of. And then because it's driving a potential cost factor, mm-hmm. then maybe there's some restrictions on what the surveillance is used, how much, how many people, because that can drive up. But it's also intrusive. I mean, if I've got my permit, I want, what the hell are you doing on my property again? So,
yeah, I sure hope they're doing everything right. And they should be. You are correct.
That was the point of the inspection in the first place. If I second guessed every, you know, it's like in the classroom. If my principal didn't like the fact that I didn't have my bulletin board done and they wanted to come in to make sure it was changed, what did that have to do with my teaching ability? So, I mean, you have to look at reasonableness when we look at regulating businesses. If it's not been a problem, I don't know why we're instituting something that can then drive costs and be more invasive. That's just my thought process.
Certainly understood. Possibly, Herb, could you maybe point out a few things that you observed during surveillance? That might be useful.
Well, when we performed surveillances, we went ahead and found clients handling food, ready-to-eat food, with no gloves on. Okay, we went ahead and found customers not washing their hands. We found them operating without soap and proper hot water. So those are the little things. We're not stopping anybody unless we happen to see something like that going on. And a lot of times when we're walking through the area, we're just walking and we're looking. We're not catching everything. We're just peeking in. And we're not going in to the property operation. It's only when something caught our eyes, we stop by and ask the question. And if they have everything, we move on. It's not that we stay there and give them 500 questions on why they have this problem. We just want to find the root of the problem, if they have a problem, and move on, help them out. You know, we don't want to have a problem develop.
Have you ever issued demerits then to any of these when you've been out there doing the surveillance?
No.
Okay.
No.
So
it's not a demerited thing. They're pass fail for temporary food establishments.
The only thing that can happen is if their operation is so poor that we have to stop them completely, shut them down, and then let them regroup, and then we'll go ahead and watch what they need to do, get them on the right track, and then we reopen them and we move on.
And how often does that happen?
In this big event, we were fortunate we didn't have to do that. You know, we were fortunate.
How many people?
But in the past, there have been events that we had to go ahead and stop them. And we had to go ahead and get a hold of the event coordinator, explain what we did. So it is all time consumed in that. You know, and we get the event coordinator involved because a lot of times they're involved with support equipment. You know, but NASCAR, I have to say, we didn't have that particular problem. It ran pretty much smooth where we didn't have to close any vendors.
So to wrap this up, so when I go back to that screen, because it isn't in my thingy, the $177 an hour is tied to what?
That would be our cost at time and a half, which with these large events,
because of
we're not going to be seeing the time and a half.
We're
just straight time because of them being covered with the adjusted work week per
the
contract.
Who's the person that's charging that then? What are they out there to do?
The persons that are out there doing surveillance, they would be doing the quick walkthrough like Herb is indicating. And
so it goes back to the new policy that came into play for surveilling that we didn't used to do, and now a business is going to get dinged for that if we adopt this new fee schedule. Is that what I'm
there are only in 2015 there were only 6 overtime hours, if I'm reading that correctly.
That's correct
because of
the mandatory adjusted work week,
the new union contract.
Yes.
So it's mostly at the lower rate, but it's still, you know, you're looking at 230 total hours in the field. If I go back to that second page, you know, where you've got five personnel training at 5.5 hours each, 2 personnel training 6.5 hours each, surveillance 19.2 hours, inspection 3. Even if I add all that up, you know, you're talking about 60 hours there. So I don't really see where the other 160 hours is coming from.
Okay. The inspectors doing the actual inspections out there. We actually broke out the training, the persons out there, which were the environmental health trainees, and we also broke out the surveillance. Just so if those things were eliminated, if you add up those 3 amounts, the revenue loss would decrease by $7,000. So if you look at the page with the cost analysis on it for NASCAR 2017, if that went down by $7,754, then our cost override would go down to under $10,000. I hope I'm explaining that clearly.
No, I think I understand. I just don't know where all the hours are coming from in the field, and
I think
that goes to the points that have been made about training as well as about surveillance, and you know, what's really mm-hmm. a reasonable amount under the circumstances. It's hard. I'm not saying it's not necessary. It may be necessary, but I don't have something in front of me that breaks it down into, you know, exactly what we are spending our time doing out there. I do agree that training, we should not be charging for training at all.
That's why we
because,
wrote that.
You know, it's necessary, but that's really our own time mm-hmm. that we should be doing. And unless we want to give a substantially reduced rate to mm-hmm. for trainees being out there, then maybe a particular operation would say, okay, yeah, let me take the trainees instead of your well-trained people. But that's really our issue that we have to deal with, and we shouldn't be passing that cost through.
And that's why we broke it out, is that those are things which I think we would consider as not necessarily part of the charge. We did know this year that the event coordinator for that massive event, as far as for looking at their infrastructure, was only charged $290. That footprint is enormous. It takes a number of experienced staff to go through and do the adequate inspections of all the food establishments, so that if you happen to look at the EH expenses, you can see the total amount of EH time.
And if I may just add, if we don't do surveillance, I'll guarantee you there will be illnesses. And that's the concern.
Right, and I don't think the objection's been necessarily to surveillance per se, but what I've heard is, you know, what's reasonable under the circumstances, and I don't know, because I can't see it broken down here. It's hard. I guess the point is, it's hard for us to make that judgment call as a board, because we don't know the details about what's happening out there. But so a cap makes sense if we're just looking for a global solution that we can live with today, or, you know, if we want to table this till the next meeting, whatever we want to do, but. That makes sense, so we can kind of judge. It is subjective no matter what you do. I mean, you can put a dollar amount on it. It's really just a subjective number that we're throwing out there. We're trying to – I understand we got to try to balance this, and there's no perfect way to do it. But it leaves a lot of questions open for me, at least, as to exactly – you know, what are real hard costs versus what are kind of just these fluffy costs we want to throw in there. So – I don't think anybody here is saying, no, we don't want public health. We do, but it's a balance that we're dealing with there. Cynthia.
I think that one thing, maybe we could come up with a better word than surveillance. That does seem a little cloak and dagger. you know, and just, I'm at a loss for a word at the moment. But also just the idea that I think it was well said that, you know, it's not like this is our first big rodeo. We should be able to project how much that's going to cost us, not including any training, which should be come out of, you know, the district's pocket, so that it's not so arbitrary.
And along with that, I think just the whole ability to judge what you're going to have to pay. I mean, if you're somebody coming in to do an event and, you know, it's an open-ended question, right. You're looking at that going, well, okay, can I, you know, am I really going to take that risk? Should I have to take that risk? The more certainty you can put into the equation, the better able a particular vendor or an event coordinator or whoever is going to be able to make that judgment call and decide, you know, how big should we make this? Are we willing to do this? Is this particular vendor willing to pay that much? You know, those types of questions. You have to have certainty, and it does drive some people away if they either don't know how much, or if it's an unreasonable amount, they're going to say it's just too cost prohibitive.
And if I may, that's why I recommended 7,000. You can do whatever you want. I think 10,000 probably would help us to recoup all of those, and I'll use the phrase legitimate, even though I think all of them are legitimate. Those legitimate costs, but $7,000 for these events probably shouldn't be that onerous, and would guarantee that the surcharge or the aftercharge would be no more than that. And then we can come back to you with a report next year as to how well we made that.
And when you say aftercharge, you're talking about the temporary vendor permits?
I'm talking about the hourly fee that shows up on this event as a negative number, but yes.
But it's driven by the surveillance.
But what goes into that equation, I think, is the question for us. We don't know what makes up that that net number. I mean, we have some indication here in the, you know, the second page where you put some of the hours that we're training, but we don't exactly know what all the other numbers are.
Dr. Reiser, if I may, Jackie Reiser, Director of Environmental Health. Is there a way that we can table this and work with Tim Jones and perhaps other members of the board to work a process out that is feasible for all of you?
Just from my perspective, I would tell you that I think the $7,000 cap seems reasonable. I think that those, just from my experience having been a event coordinator in the past and working with the hotels that I worked with and putting on these events, there is an expectation of surveillance. Once you own a permit,
thank you.
The health code tells you that you could be inspected at any time. You know, what's maybe a little bit different in this regard is these are temporary events. They're going to be here for a short period of time. It's not like you receive a complaint at a restaurant. There's not a charge to go back to the restaurant when you do a complaint inspection. You know, you've paid your one fee for your permit for the year. So this is a different animal in that regard. But I think if we're looking at 60 vendors and there's a $7,000 cap, that seems a reasonable number to live with. It would be $116 per vendor if you were going to charge the full $7,000, which is also a number that I think you could project as something to live with. So I would recommend that we go forward with the proposal to have a $7,000 cap, that we continue to work with these operators. If there's five, or even if we had, you know, a larger number in the next year, let's say we even had 10 in the next year, working with them so that they know if you've done everything under your effort to have a good and well-organized, safe event, you're not going to have any back charges. But if you don't do that, you're at risk for $7,000.
Mr. Chair?
I so move.
I would second that. I think my argument here has not been about the attempt at the permit. It's about the back cap. I will welcome Jackie's offer, though, because I think during the public workshops, as we talk about the food changes, the concept of surveillance, Tim's right. I mean, there should be an expectation. Usually it's triggered by something to have someone come back in and check you. So maybe we can talk about how to define that in a better means. But as long as if we approve this as a board, we review it in a year, and then we track what causes the 177, the 118, the one whatever, because I still don't have my head wrapped around what that is, then at least that allows us for July 1st to start to move forward. And then in a year, we'll come back and look at that, and then we still have the whole issue of the food code, and maybe that's part of where we have some discussions on the definitions of what we mean by surveil and come up with a kinder, gentler term of some sort.
Gestapo? Just joking.
No.
If I may, you have a motion and a second. Can I try to repeat what I think I hear the motion is?
Absolutely.
Or would you like to do that?
No, go ahead.
I think what I hear the motion is to accept the fee schedule as proposed by Environmental Health for event coordinator fees with a cap on the large over 60 vendor events being no more than $7,000 in back charges related to hourly work related to that event.
And I think with a staff directive to come back to us with more discussion on this over the course of the next year, maybe some examples from these larger events as they happen so we can see exactly what happened with each event or with some of the events.
We will track this anyway, and we'll be glad to come back at whatever frequency you like. Perhaps at the beginning of the fiscal year 2017, after we have this full year done. However you'd like, however frequently you'd like it.
Okay. Does that reflect your motion? And we have a second. All in favor?
Excuse me. It's a public hearing.
Okay. Public hearing. Anybody wishing to speak from the audience? Thank you. Seeing none, we have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? That motion carries. Thank you. We'll move to number two, which is consider approve variance request to permit an existing individual sewage disposal system on an undersized lot served by an off-site public water supply with a deep absorption pit within 20 feet of a structure and 10 feet of the property lines. for APN 129-36510026.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. My name is Dan LaRubio, and I am the Environmental Health and Engineer Supervisor for the Septic System Program here at the Health District. We have two variances to bring to you today. The first one is owned by Ms. Karen Federlek. She's the sole owner requesting a variance to use and permit an existing unpermitted septic system on an undersized lot served by an off-site public water supply with a deep absorption pit within 20 feet of a building and septic tank within 8 feet of a building. Also, the existing septic system is within 10 feet of the property line. The lot is located at 4550 Aspen Avenue in Charleston Park Resort, an unrecorded subdivision in Mount Charleston. Staff cannot recommend to the Board of Health a variance application without assuring the variance would not endanger or tend to endanger human health and safety. Compliance with the regulations from which the variance is sought would produce serious hardship without equal or greater benefit to the public. Staff is of the opinion that the granting of this variance will tend to endanger human health. The existing leach pit doesn't have the capacity for the intended use and could contaminate groundwater. Staff recommends denial of this variance as explained by the three reasons specified as follows. The existing leach pit does not have the capacity for a minimum 1,000-gallon septic tank with a minimum of 3 minutes per inch percolation rate. The ISDS capacity, as calculated by Ronald G. Moreno, Nevada Registered Mechanical Engineer, does not comply with the requirements of the District Board of Health regulations for septic systems. Assumptions made in Mr. Moreno's calculations are not consistent with this SNHD ISDS regulations revised in February of 2009. Finally, the owner is asking the permission to add an addition to the property, just about doubles the size of the area of the building. And also, there's potential that with not having capacity in the septic system, there will be backups of sewage into the house. So those are the main reasons we're asking for denial of the variance. Here today is Ms. Carolyn Federlek. Federlek.
Yes.
And if she could come up to the podium and speak her case.
Hello, I'm Karen Federlek. Wow, this is really loud. Hello, Mr. Bruce Woodbury Beltway. Which do you prefer, the northern, western, or southern Beltway? Hello, do I have to get up that close, or can I speak? Okay. Hello. I bought the cabin back in February of 2013. Your papers there says April of 2013. That's incorrect. It was in February. And I bought the cabin with the intent of retiring up there someday. I spent the $8,000 on getting building plans to put an addition on it. That's not the problem. And then I found out that the septic was unpermitted that's on the property. It was put in sometime in 1990 because I've spoke to a previous owner, Jeff Anderson. When he bought the property and had it, there was two 50-gallon barrels in the front of the property. Then this person, Janie Carter, bought the property in 1990. I believe that'd be the person that put the septic in. I've got photos of the septic that's there. Do I just hand these to?
Sure.
This is the septic, the seepage pit. This is the lid that's on it, concrete, big massive concrete lid. These are all pictures of the septic. Oh, I'm going to wait to get to these. It's an official septic system. It's called a seepage pit. Most people up on the mountain have leach fields which you can't drive on. You lose all that portion of your property. I think that's why Janie chose to go with the seepage pit. It's got about a foot, 1 foot thick concrete lid on top of it, which you can drive an 18-wheel truck on top of it, and it won't bother it. But that person was unavailable for me to talk to because the people that bought it afterwards, Ben, when he bought it, the seepage pit was already there. So I came along, I buy it. I go through all the different ropes that you have to go through. I had two different boring expeditions up there from the Black Mountain Geotech at about $2,000 a pop. Dave Mills right here, he's my building contractor. He went up there. He did a different, you see the crane there that's lifting the lid? He's the one that was a separate expedition that went up there with heavy equipment to dig. So I've been trying to meet all of this different compliance on all this list, variance worksheet that you have here, which I've done. My perk rate, which was one of the borings that I had to have up there, the perk rate on my property is less than 2 minutes per inch. It comes in at 0.52 to 1.63 minutes per inch. They dug an 8-foot hole that was about 8 inches wide, tried filling it with water, two different holes. Took him probably a half hour before the thing would even fill up with water. This is how fast my property perks out water. And when he finally did, that's the rate he could come up with. When it would finally hold water, it would only hold it for about, an 8-foot deep hole. Water went out that fast. Water goes in, water goes out. The Southern Nevada Health District, their regulations are based on a 15-minute per inch perk rate, down to a minimum of 3 minutes percolation rate. It says in, according to Section 11.25, of the Southern Nevada District Board of Health regulations, provisions not covered by these regulations shall meet the requirements of the latest edition of the Uniform Plumbing Code. All of the 4550 Aspen Avenue's unique soil characteristics were taken into account by Ronald G. Mariano. He's here with me. Now, his evaluation of my existing ISDS uses formulas derived from the American Society of Plumbing Engineers and information of the 2012 Uniform Plumbing Code, which that letter is attached in your information packet there. Mr. Mariano, he's going to be speaking also. Mr. Mariano concludes that the existing seepage pit will handle the sewage flow rate being of adequate size and depth. I'm going to be the only one living there. I'm single. I don't have any kids. And when I do retire, once I get my addition built up there, which I can't go any further until I get the septic permitted, either that or it's going to have to be dug up, which is expensive, since you've seen the concrete lid that's on it. That's not going to be easy to get rid of. Let me see. Where was I? So I'm the only one that's going to be living up there. Mr. Mariano has concluded it would work for up to four people. The only time I'd ever have four people up there is if I'd have people visiting. It's just going to be my retirement home. That's where I choose to retire. I'm an artist. I want to have a studio in one room, a master in the other. Part of the unique characteristics of the property is taken in these photos that I'll show you. Here's my property. But see how rocky it is here? Even just, it's different from this property that's directly behind me. Hardly any rocks. This is my neighbor. Very different soil. Oops, sorry.
This is Karen.
And these are two other properties that are also just completely different. I think that Ben, I appreciate the work that he does. He works for you guys really hard. But I don't think he's taking into consideration the very unique characteristics that are on my property, which is below. A lot of them are outside of the parameters of the Southern Nevada Health District regulations. And again, I'll repeat myself, as according to Section 11.25, that's when you refer to the latest edition of the Uniform Plumbing Code and the American Society of Plumbing Engineers, which I'll have Ron come up and speak now. Any questions, though, for me?
Actually, I do have a question. Well, I have two questions. One, have there been any known prior issues?
None. With this septic system?
None.
And do you have any complaints or objections by any adjoining property owners?
None. In fact, they're kind of jealous because, well, you can park on yours. I see so many people up there. I know where their septic is, but I see them parking on them. That would frighten me there because it can ruin the integrity of the leach field itself.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Which subdivision are you in?
I'm in Old Town.
You're in Old Town, so are you on Yellow
I'm on Aspen.
Pine? Aspen,
I'm
okay.
On the back road.
You're on the
back
side,
yeah.
So I hate to say it, but there's somebody up there that still uses barrels.
Yeah.
Be looking at that one versus the septic.
You used to.
Okay. So you have your setback is fine from the property line. You have no issues with
according to other variances that have been approved in the neighborhood.
And you've had it. You can access it. So you've had it pumped. I'm assuming since you bought the property in 2013.
It's been. We've got the lids off of it. There was no need to.
Okay. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Nita.
Just a quick question. Now, how large is the, how many gallons is the septic tank?
That's, Ron can answer those questions. He knows all the big words.
It's 1,000 gallons.
Would you come on up to the microphone, please?
It's actually 2,500.
Good morning, sir. My name is Ron Mariano. I'm a mechanical engineer, the state of Nevada. The basis of my evaluation is to look at different parameters. Basically, I reverse engineered the existing septic system. I took into account the flow rate from the facility, the PERC, and based on my calculation, it's sufficient. The health district uses a different set of parameters under calculations. As Mrs. Fedelec explained, there are different soil characteristics throughout the valley, and I use the soil at her house to base my evaluation on. The alternate materials and method showed that the existing system does work. It's been working for many years. There's no sewage backup, as I know of, has been reported. And in my professional opinion, the system is sufficient and complies with all standards of the American Society of Plumbing Engineers and the Uniform Plumbing Code. If there is an incident, I'm putting my stamp on the line. So if it does backflow, then of course the calculation is incorrect. But at this time and with the new addition, I have determined from my calculations that it will work.
How big is this structure?
The structure currently is about...
And including with the addition?
Additional fixtures.
This is Dave, my building contractor.
Too, we can come up. Good morning, gentlemen, ladies. Dave Mills with Reliable Construction. The actual addition, the structure that's there now is approximately 800 square feet, and we're looking to add approximately another 800 square feet to it, which still, with the new addition and buildings, we still meet all the setbacks and stuff that's required for the septic system or seep pits that's there.
How many bedrooms and bathrooms, including the addition?
With existing now is one bedroom and one bathroom. We're going to maintain one bedroom and add a second bathroom.
And just one kitchen area?
One kitchen area.
Okay. Tim?
So as I see what the health district regulation is looking for, a 1,000-gallon septic tank, does that not exist or it does exist?
It does exist.
And you guys agree that there is a 1,000-gallon
tank? There's a 1,500-gallon
tank. Actually, it's a 1,500-gallon septic tank.
Say again.
And then so the
actually a 1,500-gallon. The minimum requirement is 1,000. We actually have a 1,500.
And so the leach field is the issue.
Yeah, the issue is the absorption pit, yeah.
Yes. And so we're hearing that as the engineering has looked at it, they're getting better than a 3 minutes per inch.
Well, as far as the perc rate, we accept 3 minutes per inch as the minimum perc rate that's acceptable.
You don't want it going faster than that?
If you accept 2 minute or 3 minute per inch, it doesn't change the calculation by significant amount. It it's like a 10% difference. So that's not in question. If you want to use 2 minutes per inch, fine. But in our calculations, in our regulations, we don't accept anything less than a 3 minutes per inch per grate.
We'll give you what a per grate you get. We'll give you three, and if you get a better per grate than that, we'll allow you to have that one as well.
I was going to say, Mr. Chair, I used to do the perk rates on the mountain. I shouldn't tell people that, but my husband and I actually did the perk rates. Yeah. And the perk rate on Mount Charleston, no matter where you're at, Echo, otherwise, it's phenomenal. So yeah, you have no problems.
That's not in question.
It actually is in question according to the Southern Nevada Board of Health District regulations, which states in section, and for the third time, 11.25, provisions not covered by these regulations shall meet the which were outside the parameters shall meet the latest requirements of the latest edition of the Uniform Plumbing Code.
Yes.
So if I could just get back to my question, the what I'm reading here says the existing leach pit does not have the capacity for a minimum 1,000-gallon septic tank. Well, we have better than a 1,000-gallon septic tank with a minimum of 3 minutes per inch percolation rate. If my are we saying that faster is good or not good? Because I'm hearing them say they were
actually insignificant in this case. The problem is that the leach pit doesn't have the capacity that the septic tank has, and then it will not handle the flow that's going to come from the house.
Got it.
The flow from one person.
We base our flow based on the number of fixture units.
So
not
if I could get back to the engineer, do you agree or disagree with that?
I dispute that, sir. I really do. Based on my calculations.
Can you go to the microphone, please?
And like I said, I reverse engineered the existing system. And again, the standards they're using, there's safety factors in everything that we do when we design a septic system. I looked at, like I said, the perk test. The key is looking at the absorption area. And that's what I arrived to. I looked at a different absorption area than what they looked at. The absorption area that I'm using is smaller than what they calculated.
And if I could get back to Ed, then why not accept his analysis?
He's looking at the use, the calculations based on use. When you do a septic system, you calculate based on use versus based on fixed unit. And you take whichever is a larger number. In our case, the fixed unit amount creates a larger need than does the use create. So you can't go by use only. You have to look at the fixture count capacity also.
Could, I mean, if the tank was filled to 1,500 gallons, would the system work?
The septic system doesn't work that way, sir. If it was filled to capacity, then of course you will have problems. But as it currently stands, there's no backflow to the existing residents. And the fixture units that they're using versus the flow rate that I'm using is consistent. It's just that the numbers, and I don't dispute that. It's the absorption area that I'm looking at. The flow rates that I'm using is consistent with her usage. So in essence, if we force her to go with a larger seepage pit, it's oversizing the system based on the actual usage.
So if somebody bought the house in the future and had a family with six people in there?
It would still work, sir.
That's exactly the concern that we have.
And my calculation is based on four people, sir. Four people living in the house. 300 gallons per day. That's what my calculation is based on.
And your calculations say what?
Based on fixture count, the minimum size would be a 1,000-gallon system. And the absorption field has to match the size of the tank, which is 1,000 gallons minimum. So what's needed is 350 square feet of absorption area. What Mr. Morani has come up with is 85.71 square feet of absorption area. That it would be their capacity for the seepage pit. And I did a calculation myself for the seepage pit. It has a capacity of around 115 square feet, and you need 350 square feet for it to function properly.
And so you're saying he's basing his on just
on use.
Just on use based on, but you're saying not just one person, but up to four. And you're saying you haven't even looked at the number of the use or the number of people. You're just looking at the number of fixtures.
Well, you can compare the use versus the number of fixture units. There's two methods. If you look at the use, and you, if you bump that up to 10 people in a house or something like that,
it's based
it
on
probably
fixtures.
Still won't be equal or
greater. Wait. Let them
probably
speak,
still
please.
Still will not be equal or greater than the fixture count needed. The need from the fixture count will probably still override the need of the use, no matter how many people you put in there. It's a question of the fact that you have a certain number of fixture units, up to 20 fixture units. You need a 1,000-gallon septic tank and the proper absorption area that goes with that, and that is 350 square feet of absorption area.
And how many fixture units do we have in with the addition?
I think there are 14. Is that
that includes 11? Toilets and as well as sinks,
yes,
and all that?
There's 11.
It's a little less than 20, so we go with the minimum of 1,000 gallons needed. And he has a 1,500-gallon tank there, so they have the capacity in the septic tank, but not in the leach field, in the seepage pit.
So in your opinion, if we limited the approval to a certain maximum number of people occupying,
that
it wouldn't
no.
matter?
No.
Okay.
Anita has a question then.
Anita.
Okay, so what does a denial in this case mean? Does this mean that she has to dig all this up, or, I mean, what exactly does that mean?
We're saying we can't give her a permit on that system. That system is unpermitted.
You're talking
at
about
this
the permit
time.
For the expansion, though.
The permit
no,
for the
no
septic
permit.
System. It okay. doesn't have. They don't have a permit yet.
So
they need to get
what
a permit.
Does not having a permit mean? I mean, how does she doesn't meet your qualifications here?
Right.
So what does that mean? What does she need to do? What is the next step then?
She'll have to create an efficient system in the leach field or leach pit or whatever she chooses to use to handle that amount of flow and create 350 square feet of leach area, absorption area, if you will.
So basically what would have to be done is the leach, the seepage pit would have to be increased to 350 square feet.
Question?
Did you get kicked out of the house? So
Chris?
Remind me, because it's been a long time since I put my leach field and pit in. the leach is really your backup plan. Your sewage goes into your tank. And if she has the capability, which we all do, to pump it, I think I've had mine pumped once in 30 years.
That's a mistake.
Yeah, that's a mistake.
I'm very frugal with my water. But I understand the reg, but I really don't think the risk factor is here that we are looking for in what we try to do on our codes. I'm going to tell you, I'm surprised. Thank you for even coming forward and asking for a permit, because I'll bet you in Old Town, there's probably five people that have a permit legitimately up there, and that's not to say it's just how it was done back in the day.
She's trying to do an addition, and she cannot.
And that triggered that, exactly, and I understand.
Have
that.
A permit on a set.
Right.
On a
seat.
Unless illegally build. I would like to legally build.
Correct. And I appreciate that. But when I look, and I appreciate staff, because we have to do things based on minimums, and the new code's right. in place, and the new plumbing code was, international code was adopted. But really, if we look at it from the reasonable side of it, I don't believe it puts anybody at risk, and it actually gets it into compliance, and I don't think you're ever going to trigger it with the number of fixtures there. And maybe there's a caveat. I mean, shame on people for not even disclosing that to folks when they buy a property. That should have happened. So unfortunately, you're stuck with something that way as well. So I don't know. I'm kind of personally leaning towards, I've never had my stuff leach, and I can tell you down the street where the health district didn't require them to put a wall in, and they should have for their leach field, but they've never had an issue either. So I don't think the risk is there that we're talking about. So this may be a reasonable way, without creating a precedence, to get somebody into compliance.
You're asking us to permit a previously unpermitted system. We did not look at that system before. We did not have our inspector go out and look at this system before. And from what the gentleman has shown me on photographs, the leach pit will not have capacity for the minimum use. We're not even considering the 1,500-gallon
tank capacity. We're just saying a minimum of 1,000 gallons capacity.
Right. And basic mechanics on those systems, just to clarify, is that the septic tank, the concrete tank that's in the ground, the purpose of which has a baffle in it, and all the solids stay in the tank.
Correct.
Okay.
And that's what you
call the liquid goes under the baffle and out into the seepage pit, and the liquid that is, and that's where all the liquid is disposed of is dispersed into the ground.
Correct. And the perk rate,
which is
fine,
why,
so.
Which is based on the perk rate and the square footage, mm-hmm. gives you your absorption rate and. Approval or disapproval of
so
meeting the
requirements. Your mind, there's no way for you to go down if there's nothing in here right now to make the inspection on the tank?
Well, I mean, when I've dug it up, you can see I've dug up the whole side of it at their request and to take pictures. I mean, I asked them, do you want to come up and look at it? We went through the expense of bringing up excavators to dig this thing up. They told me pictures will be sufficient. Mm-hmm. You know, so I took the pictures, tape measures, everything I can to try to bring back to them exactly what was there. And at each turn, it was a seep pit. It's not something that fits within Clark County's,
correct.
You know, box. So they're unwilling to really look at it, I think. And I think with what the requirements and stuff, and maybe it doesn't pertain to our project, but if we're imposed to have to put a new system on, the system that they're imposing to put on up at Mount Charleston, as you well know, on a 50 by 50 lot, it completely becomes illegal on everybody that's up there because there's
because Old Town's all 50 by 50.
You might as well keep a shed there. There's no reason to, you know. So there has to be something to.
And I appreciate what they're trying to do. I had come get permitted, and I was for my addition. So thank you very much. But But I do think sometimes we have to look at this as a circumstance. If there was a risk factor, I'd be telling you no. If you were the people with that have the gallon tanks that aren't—they're just gasoline tanks that are being used up there.
That's why we dug this thing up.
I appreciate you doing that because at least it gets you better into compliance. I have a complete respect for staff. I just think that this is a unique circumstance that you could do it as not precedential. You're an attorney, so you figure out how to do that, Mr. Chair. But I think. It would be adequate for what they need, and maybe there's some kind of way to word it. But.
Okay, we got Tim, and then I think John and Bill, correct? No, just Bill, okay.
Just a question for the applicant. Was it disclosed when you purchased the property that you didn't have a permitted septic system?
No, the property was foreclosed. The people I bought it as a foreclosed property. And then I paid cash for it, whereas if I'd have gone through a bank and had to borrow money to get it, that's when a bank would require a permitted septic before I even bought the property. But, you know, I've been saving up my money since I was a teenager to go buy a property.
Okay, question for Annette. Can we put a condition on the approval as to the number of fixtures and or the number of residents that can live in the property? A maximum number?
I'm going to tell you, we can't even do that in a single family resident by code. You might be able to do it based on not to exceed your 14 or something.
That's
fixtures,
what I was
possibly.
Getting at.
Could I say something? It is Old Town, so out of the 50 houses that are in Old Town, maybe three have families that live there, and of those three, most are couples, retired. So it's really not a family-oriented community where you'd have more than two or three people living there.
Tim.
Could we accommodate public health protection by adding on such as a requirement to pump on some schedule or to have an inspection on some schedule so she could live with the system as it is, and then if you do see a problem in the future, require some other action?
I could live with that. We could have her pump the tank every 5 years,
well,
like we tell everyone else.
Can
to
I
do.
Say one more thing? He mentioned there was only one
hang
tank.
Hang on.
Oh, I'm sorry.
let the board talk a little bit and don't interrupt, please. Thank you.
So I think a 5-year pump is recommended anyway. If you're going to do diligence on your tank, you ought to pump it every 5 years. So do you think you could live with that?
Now can I speak? I'm not sure if that's, like you say, a septic system is a living entity. If you take care of it, it takes care of you. It takes care of you. There's actual enzymes in there that eat the stuff. They live down in there. It's its own little environment. And there's also two tanks.
Let me just back up. Could you live with pumping it every
yes.
5 years? Yeah. That's all we need to hear.
But I do have one more. There is two tanks that it goes through, not just one. He had said there was one. It went into the waste, went into one tank, then it went to the septic.
Yeah, that's the construction.
There's
anyone else wishing to speak?
Two.
Questions, comments? Yes, doctor.
I just want to make clear, there's a lot of people been talking.
Never mind.
You say that you could live with the requirement that that you pump this every 5 years.
Sure.
Okay, and you said you would live with that too.
You can live with that as well.
All right, do we have a motion then?
I move to approve with a stipulation to pump every fifth year.
Second.
All in favor?
Public
hearing.
Aye.
Oh, hang on.
I think we need to make sure.
I got censored. Okay. Public hearing.
Oh, public hearing.
Anyone else? Thank you. Anyone else wishing to speak on this item?
I think Bruce needs to nudge you every once in a while.
Yeah, he's not doing his job. Okay, we have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Thank you.
And that motion carries. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for letting me interrupt every 5 minutes.
All right, we are on to number three, which is to consider a variance request to permit and install an ISDS on an undersized lot served by an offsite public water supply and a deep absorption trench within 20 feet of a structure and 10 feet of the property lines, APN 129-361-11032.
Right. Thomas J. Murphy, sole owner, is requesting a variance to install an individual sewage disposal system on an undersized lot, but it's in the Cathedral Rock View subdivision in Mount Charleston. The address is 4780 Silver Tip Trail. Staff would not be able to recommend to the Board of Health a variance application without assuring this variance would not endanger or tend to endanger human health or safety, and also that compliance with the regulations from which the variance is sought would produce serious hardship without equal or greater benefit to the public. Staff is of the opinion that the granting of this variance will not endanger or tend to endanger human health, provided the applicant agrees to and complies with the four conditions recommended by staff and subject to the Board of Health approval as shown on pages 2 and 3 of the memo.
Thank you. Any questions or comments? Yes.
So this is up in Cathedral. What's the square footage of the lot then?
Okay.
They're a little bit bigger than an old town.
It's it's 0.09 acre gross. 0.09. It's about twice the size of the
other. And so you're going to require trenching, it looks like.
It's a trench, yes.
Okay, so they have the ability, because some of the topography there is a little bit different. So,
right.
But they're able to
they
do
have,
that part.
They have enough room on the property okay. to make this happen.
Okay, thank you.
Anyone else?
Are they here?
Yes, the representative for the owners here, Mr. Dale Martin. You can speak on this.
I'm Dale Martin, owner of Hardin & Sons, and I'm the contractor for Mr. Murphy to put the new system in.
Is the owner willing to agree to the four conditions?
Yes.
Got a motion?
I so move.
Looks like I'm going to get censored here because Bruce. All right, Bruce, your pay is getting docked today. Sorry. We're going to have to cut down the size of our lunch. All right, public hearing. Anyone wishing to speak from the audience? All right, now we have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? And that carries.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you.
All right, we are on to Roman numeral 5, Report, discussion, action. Number one, Office of Informatics Program Overview.
So good mid-morning, and for the record, my name is Cassius Lockett, Director of Community Health, and today I'm here to discuss the Office of Public Health Informatics. So just to start with an overview, the Office of Informatics is in a Division of Community Health, and within the Division of Community Health, there are several programs, starting with our Public Health Lab, our Chronic Disease Prevention and Health Promotion Unit, our Epidemiology and Disease Surveillance. We have also the Office of Public Health Preparedness, Emergency Medical Service and Trauma Systems, Vital Statistics, and of course today we're going to talk about the Office of Informatics, which is comprised of three FTEs. The division is comprised of approximately 80 FTEs. We have one senior public health informatics scientist, Jay Boyer, who's next to me. And we also have two public health informatics scientists, Sony Vargas and Lei Jang. Would you like to stand up, identify yourself? Thank you very much, appreciate that.
Wow, there's more titles out there.
So, what is health informatics? I like to kind of start off with definitions so we can make sure that we're all on the same page. So informatics is a discipline that's focused on the acquisition or acquirement, storage and use of information in a specific setting or domain. So you can have the domain of dentistry, medicine, you can have several domains. Public health is one. And so just to comment briefly on the domain of medicine, actually that's the oldest form of informatics. It's been around for over 40 years. Initially, there were physicians who were trained with PhDs in computer science, and they developed some languages that are still being used today in computer systems. One of them is a language called MUMPS, the Massachusetts Utility Multiple Programming Language, also known as M for short. But there's some electronic health records that you may be familiar with. One is EPIC. EPIC is still actually today written in MUMPS. So, moving forward here, informatics is really more about managing information and people than technology. And in fact, in the informatics world, there's kind of like a rule of thumb we use, and that is when we talk about implementing projects, we kind of look at it as, you know, 80% of project failure is due to people and 20% due to technology. I like to say it's probably 90% people and 10% technology. But also informatics is sometimes defined as an activity at the crossroads of people, information, and technology. So what informatics is and what it isn't. It's not scientists or clinicians tinkering around with computers. It's not what it is. It's not analysis of large data sets, even though now there's this thing called big data, and epidemiologists always have analyzed big data, but now healthcare are hiring data scientists to do that type of work. It's not the deployment of an electronic health record or the profession of health information management or anything that has to do with computers. What it is someone that's kind of cross-trained in the informational sciences that meet a specific application domain. So we have nursing informatics. And nursing informatics, by the way, is the only accredited type of informatics that exists today. So medical informatics is still trying to move in that direction to be accredited. Public health is been recognized as a profession, but not quite accredited yet. But what informatics is so it's a really new profession, even though it's been around for 40 years, if that makes sense. So what it is the relentless pursuit of assisting people. So I mentioned that's why we don't like projects to fail in informatics world. And so when we take on these projects, we really like to focus on things like the business process, system development, and system implementation. So I just wanted to discuss briefly, not going into too much detail because these are documents that are hundreds of pages long. Currently, if you are fortunate to have an informatics program or a unit in the public health world, and we're fortunate to do that courtesy of the vision by Dr. Madaw, what we can do is align some of our activities up in informatics with meaningful use, or some of the initiatives that are currently going around. And meaningful use refers to the provisions in the 2009 Information Technology for Economic and Clinical or the High Tech Act. And meaningful use authorized incentive payments through Medicare and Medicaid to clinicians and hospitals to use an electronic health record in a meaningful way. And so those eligible providers are kind of outlined here for Medicaid and for Medicare, and then there's the eligible hospitals. Meaningful use is broken up into three stages, stage one, two, and three. Stage one was initially intended to pretty much capture data and kind of try and share it and exchange it between entities. Stage two focused on bringing in some of the advanced practices from clinicians. So whether we're trying to do medication reconciliation, or whether we're trying to bring in clinical decision support systems to help doctors do their job better, or computerized physician order entry, or order sets for diabetics, et cetera. So everything is coordinated. That came into stage two. Stage three focused on trying to improve outcomes, and that's where we're at right now as we're looking at the proposed rule and trying to digest that, which came out last month, so into several hundred pages. And you'll see on one of the slides, I tried to compress the essence of those several hundred page document into what it might mean for the informatics program. So one thing I want to point out, however, is that meaningful use did not incentivize public health to receive, process, or even make the data meaningful in any way. And in fact, I was one of the individuals who raised this issue approximately 4 years ago when the national agenda was set for public health informatics and at a CDC meeting. And that, and everyone's on the same page, you know. We're receiving a storm of information, but most of the 3,000 local health departments in the United States do not have the infrastructure or to receive this information, process it, or even make it meaningful or actionable. We're very fortunate to have an informatics program to assist with this process. So just looking at, for meaningful use, just real quick, looking at the public health objectives associated with meaningful use. So eligible providers can submit one or choose one public health measure. And so they can choose to select and send to a state immunization registry that information, or they can send syndromes to local health or a state health entity. Eligible hospitals can choose any one of the three. They can choose immunizations, they can choose to send electronic laboratory reports, or they can choose to send syndromes. And syndromes are a symptom that precedes a diagnosis. So we're talking about influenza-like illness, partial face paralysis, those kinds of things that are in those kind of systems. And so I'll probably gloss this over some of those slides, but we are working on several systems. One is BioSense and the other one is Essence, and I'll go into detail briefly about those. So this is a slide of the United States just showing some of the activity by eligible hospitals, and you can see for us we're within the 71% to 80% range of those eligible hospitals who have selected and submitted at least one public health measure. That public health measure is probably the syndromes and the electronic laboratory reports. And we currently, I think, Jay, we're sending, what, 13? We have 13 acute care hospitals out of 17.
Hospitals reporting, yeah.
Yeah. So just real quick, this is meaningful use, proposed rule three. This is very interesting. Just came out, still being digested by public health and the medical community. And one thing that's different than the proposed rule for meaningful use two is you see this measure three. First of all, we have six measures now in public health. Before we had three, now there's six. What's interesting is that measure three is what we've always wanted NRS 441A requires us to for providers and labs to submit notifiable or reportable disease conditions to us so we can capture those. Now this proposed rule will allow us to automate that process, so that's fantastic news, using specific standards. Also, eligible providers, looking at this table here, one thing that's also interesting is that if you look at Measure 4 and 5, these are brand new measures. And what they basically say is if you're an eligible provider or hospital, you are now allowed to just submit one of those, meaning that they could now bypass sending us electronic laboratory reports, syndromes, or immunization data to an immunization registry, which in a way is a little scary for us. So we hope some of that scope changes during the public comment period. For example, clinical data registries, that's very interesting because now providers can speak to providers and send data from an electronic health record to a congestive heart failure registry or a hemoglobin A1C registry and bypass public health in total, since we don't usually own and operate those kind of systems. But we do own and operate a public health registry called TriSano that you're all familiar with. So the mission of informatics is to manage resources, health information, and technology to create actionable data to improve the health of Southern Nevada. So that kind of encompasses also the definitions and what informatics is all about that we discussed earlier. So informatics also is aligned with meaningful use, and we have four cornerstones that are a component of our program that we use to do that. Number one, reportable disease, that's a mandate, NRS 441A, and we use TriSano to do so. The RCKMS, I'll talk about that in a minute. There's a lot, I know, TLA and three-letter words and four-letter words in the informatics world, so I tried to remove as many of those as I could, but it's kind of difficult. The reportable condition knowledge management system grant we got, and I'll talk about that momentarily, is going to address partly, anyway, case reporting, so we're excited about that. Mentioned to you before, we're doing electronic laboratory reporting, and I'll show you a little bit of data related to that. One of the things we're having great difficulty with is healthcare integration, but everyone in the country who has an informatics program, we're all struggling, and there's only a couple of pilots in the United States that are trying to accomplish healthcare integration by connecting your actual disease registry with an electronic health record so that data entry is reduced on both sides. We don't want to see charts in doctors' offices. You know, we want to make everything as paperless as possible, even though we all agree that paper has a bright future, so it's not going anywhere. Situational awareness. Again, I mentioned to you just briefly that, this is a symptom that precedes a diagnosis, influenza-like illness, things of that nature, and the State Department of Public and Behavioral Health has received a federal opportunity announcement for a national initiative to improve situational awareness, so they own and operate that system. The system that we're trying to bring into informatics and support for on behalf of the entire state is going to be the electronic surveillance system for the early notification of community-based epidemics. If I compare these two systems, one is an infant, in essence is a teenager, developed by the Department of Defense by Johns Hopkins University years ago. But since, several iterations of it have improved its ability significantly for us to get at the granular level and do better surveillance. So Office of Informatics, just real quick on reportable diseases and some of our alignment with meaningful use and the ELR component. One thing I wanted you to just pay attention to on this chart is that if you look at the 30,000, that's the total electronic laboratory results reported from electronic health records in 2013. If we compare that to the volume in 2014, we see a significant bump up of about 50,000. And that's primarily due to a new connection. We ended up connecting electronically to our own public health laboratory information management system, and that new connection brought in primarily STDs. So what does that look like from the 2014 connection? If we break it down by disease group, we see, again, the bulk of what we seen and observed in 2014 is STDs, followed by hepatitis and HIV. Just real quick, just kind of commented and discussed already the RCKMS partnership we have with the Council of State and Territorial Epidemiologists and CDC, which is a healthcare integration tool. We received approximately $15,000 to be one of several pilot jurisdictions in the United States. And what RCKMS does is it allows us to take laboratory information and case report and develop criteria in the form of rules where we can put out some middleware called, you know, open clinical decision support, and we could use triggers to go into an electronic health record and take that information and put it into a repository that will tell us, hey, guess what? You have a chlamydia, tuberculosis, pertussis, a case of lead in that facility. Now, the problem is that's great, but we can't get it out. And that's the healthcare integration part. How do we get it out? That's the next step. So a meeting took place February 24th in Tucker, Georgia, with all the pilot jurisdictions for this national initiative in our informatics program. The lead on that is Sony Vargas from SNHD. But you can see there was Houston, Illinois, Virginia, New York State, Florida, Oklahoma. We even had the Public Health Informatics Institute there, the National Association of Public Health Laboratories, the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials, is helping out with that, and then we have some IT organizations involved as well. So this is what it pretty much looks like. I kind of talked about it already, but really the scope of the project is outlined in green. I don't want to spend too much time on it, but those pilot jurisdictions I talked about here are developing an authoring interface, and an authoring interface was actually previewed at that February 24th meeting at Tucker, Georgia. And basically what Sony and others are doing is they're, against existing value sets, they're trying to harmonize all the reportable disease conditions with all the pilots in terms of who, what, when, where of reporting. And that will be converted into structured logic or rules. And those rules will be used to call out to other electronic health records to say, hey, do you have this disease? We're looking for it. The step is, and if you see that feedback loop here in the gray on the left-hand side that says PH reports, that's in that line that's dividing the green from the left-hand side here. That's the part that we can't do in the country. No one has figured it out. And it was a part of a rigorous discussion. It's going to take the use of additional informatics power and standards and collaboration with healthcare to figure that one out. So I talked about syndromic surveillance and what that means already. And moving on here, we talked about this already in terms of situational awareness and syndromic surveillance and the two systems we're using in terms of BioSense and Essence. One thing I'll point out is that, again, Essence will allow us, once we get it deployed for the whole state, and we're going to host it here for the whole state. The state's given us approximately $100,000 to do so, and that's paying for some of Sony's time and some of IT's time to do this project. But it will allow us in near real time to get more granular with our surveillance so we can look at things by person, place, and time, so we can map out illnesses, we can break it down by risk groups, etc. So just in summary, we have four cornerstones in the Office of Informatics program: reportable disease conditions, electronic laboratory reporting, situational awareness in terms of syndromic surveillance are all aligned with national initiatives and objectives related to meaningful use. The issue in the area that we're going to all be working towards in the future in the United States is this whole healthcare integration piece and trying to use new standards to accomplish that. And some of the issues that remain to be resolved include interoperability. That's an ongoing issue. It's always going to be an ongoing issue in the informatics world. And so we're always going to be dealing with making sure we maintain some semantical interoperability, and that is when you have information transmitted from one system to another. You want to make sure that weight means weight. You want to make sure that the race values are the same. Everything maintains the same meaning across systems. Also, syntactical interoperability. We want to make sure that when information is transmitted, doesn't get bumped into a different location. It's where we expect it to be so we can have accuracy. And so that's ongoing. That's always going to be a part of the informatics world. In terms of case reporting, we're excited that Meaningful Use Stage 3 has finally acknowledged that this is important, since the bread and butter of what we do in the core, since the mandate of all infectious disease programs in the United States has been to collect and report out and investigate communicable disease. And so this gives us an opportunity to automate that process finally. So we're excited about that and the project that we're working on in the pilot. And last, healthcare integration, that goes sort of in complements the RCKMS project. However, there are emerging standards and training needs for all informaticians to be able to accomplish this. And I listed some of the reasons why is because informatics works in the standards world. And so when we start looking at some of the standards like CDA, which stands for Clinical Document Architecture, and the FAST interoperability healthcare standard, which is, I was surprised to see that there because it's such a new, they call it FHIR. I was shocked because it's such a new standard, but that's what's going to drive and fuel case reporting. So with that said, any questions?
Thank you. Any questions? Tim?
Have you been able to use the system to take any action here in Southern Nevada?
Yes, we have another system called Pentaho, and we're using that to develop actionable reports. And so, Sony, Leigh, do you want to make a comment on that?
Good morning. I'm Leigh John, and we use open source Pentaho, the business intelligence system, to develop a lot of reports. It's a real-time dynamic reports, the chart, graphic, tables for the program grant management and the program data quality assurance, and also for the epidemiologists to prepare their chart reports. And I know our epidemiologists use reports to generate the county health assessment. I think that we publish that report every 2 years, or those things is generated from that system. That is the actionable data reports from that system.
Yeah, so we're also using Pentaho to not just look at health outcome reports, but also compliance reports. So an example of that is in vital records, we have developed using Pentaho and sitting Pentaho on top of the data, an ability to automate quickly birth registration timeliness reports, those births that have been reported within 1 to 10 days, births reported between 11 and 15 days and greater, because timeliness should be within 10 days. And if we see that any of our birthing facilities are within a very low range, then we use that as an actionable item to notify the birth clerks that this is an issue and a problem. We've used that recently, actually, and had that scenario happen. So that's another form of actionable data. We use it for compliance as well.
Yes.
At UMC, we're at stage three of the meaningful use, and so our bottom line is going to start being connected to our meaningful use data collection. How is that going to, or what stage are you at here at the health district, and how are you going to be tied to quality indicators?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So in order for the health district to qualify for meaningful use incentives, the first thing I pointed out in the presentation was that they put the cart before the horse. They basically said, hey, public health, you got to get all this information to do something with it. And most places said, we don't even have staff to get this information and understand it. So that's one thing. The other thing is, once you've seen one local health department, you've seen one local health department. And so they all look different. They're all structured quite differently. And so some of them do primary care. And so some of them look like an FQHC, or they're FQHC look-alike. And under those requirements, they actually would qualify to receive at the eligible provider level. If they have more than 10 providers, for example, they would be able to get the incentive. That's not, you know, we don't do primary care here, so we're not set up to actually receive any incentives.
Yes.
Thank you. The vital records, what was the legislation we always tried to get out of the state and we didn't, and how does that interface? Was it vital record? I can't remember what the heck it was called.
Which
they never funded, the state of Nevada never funded some kind of...
What is it, emergency...
EMS?
Is it the
emergency
management system? Is that what...
Looking at cases going to the...
Are you talking about the trauma system?
Trauma system.
Trauma system.
Oh,
thank you.
Okay.
Yes.
Would you like to that could be part of the legislative update. But there was a hearing in the assembly. It might have been the Senate. I forget which one now. We presented about that and about both the trauma registry and helping to fund EMS systems statewide.
And they didn't approve.
And they didn't do that. Now, it has gone to, I believe, the Finance Committee, who will look at it and determine whether there might be some state general funds to help fund the trauma system. There's a disagreement between the state and actually the rest of the local health authorities as to what they need to do and how they need to do it. They say that they already have a system up and running, but it actually isn't.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that we've talked to the state about is that if we can, we'd be happy to host it.
Maybe, yeah.
We'd be happy to host it for them, and that's the discussions we're having with the state health division.
That might be a bit good fallback. So it was an exempted bill then?
I believe so.
If it's in finance, it's exempted. Okay.
Fiscal note removed, and... You know, we are prepared to stand up the trauma registry and the informatics program.
And that might help you all, actually, in the long run. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, we're currently the trauma hospitals here, and the hospitals are reporting dually to the state, which doesn't provide any feedback, and to us, where we can provide some limited amount of feedback. So if we can take over and do the trauma registry for the entire state with some of this funding, we'd be happy to do that. And I've had discussions with Richard about that.
And are there any homeland security requirements with this type of a system that maybe you could get grant monies for?
No. There have.
Sometimes there's always weird umbrellas under that. Group.
Sure. There currently is, right now, you may know that the FEMA programs are meeting, and I'm a representative to them. I was up there on the 14th, and I'm going back on the 28th, where emergency workers throughout the state or emergency organizations throughout the state have recommended applied for some of this funding, and we'll vote on that on the 28th. And we're likely to put put something forward for next year. One of the things that I would like to do is right now the Fusion Center is one of the places where we think we should be to be helpful to the entire county. And we do have, who's going down?
That's Lay. Lay goes there.
Lay goes down there now one day a week, and I think Misty goes down one day a week.
Right.
And so we're trying to gear up. You know, it's a 24-hour, but we'll never be able to do that. But if we can... But if we can try to get some more people down there, then we can share that information more clearly back and forth. And that's one of the things that we might apply for funding for next year.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
I just have a question. It may or may not be related. As a practical matter, someone who delivers a premature baby at UMC, do you have an electronic mechanism for being notified so that your case managers and that and your public health can... be aware of that case to start doing the case management? That's question one.
Yeah,
question two would be the same thing, only if I was at the NASCAR and I got staff food poisoning and came down to Valley, how do you get that report?
Okay. You have any comment on that one?
Bonnie can talk about the premature babies.
No, first of all, we're not noted. Bonnie Sorensen was the nursing division.
There's no electronic.
No, there isn't. But I will tell you, Dr. Abdullah, do you know Dr. Abdullah? Okay, he has just gotten a large grant. He is now working for Positively Kids, and he's in the process of starting a follow-up clinic for high-risk neonates to do just exactly what you're saying.
Okay, so as of right now, it's telephone communication.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So
same thing, if I was sick at NASCA and I got a staff food poisoning is from one of the vendors, and I went to Valley. It's telephonic that you guys get notified?
Currently, that's the case. Okay. And so that's why case reporting is so important, because if we start to do case reporting, we'll automatically receive those in our Trisano system. And then to answer your other question, right now there's an organization, and again, there's a lot of, you know, TLAs and FLAs, three-letter and four-letter words, some of them swear words, in the informatics world. And there's, you know, there's standards for automating birth and death records. We do have an electronic birth registration record. However, it's not robust enough and doesn't follow the recommended national standards to do exactly what you just said. That's in its infancy, and there's actually a couple of pilot projects in the United States to do exactly what you just said.
I would like to make a comment, too, which is we have some software we developed here in the informatics group called the Messaging Bus. And the intent of this is to accept messages from any provider and then route them to the appropriate program. So the internally here. So the hard work's already been done on that, and we process lots of messages which come in as reports of electronic labs, but we also are set up to handle other kinds of things too. We process some EMS data using this system. So when somebody gets to the point where they can send us a report of a premature birth or a report of a staph infection, we will be able to very quickly accept that data, modify it, and route it to the right people.
Anyone else? All right. Thank you very much for your presentation. All right, we're on to board reports. Does anyone from the board wish to give a report? Seeing none, we'll move on to health officer and staff reports. Turn that over to Dr. Iser.
Sure, and we have several reports under CHO. You do have a copy of the initial cut from that we just received last week from the employee survey, so I'll ask Shirley to come up and discuss that with you. And either she or I will then discuss with you further steps related to this.
Good morning. I'm Shirley Oakley, and the Human Resource Administrator here at the Health District. We just received the results of our survey last week, and we're still in the early stages of reviewing the data. We have, however, posted the survey on our intranet for our employees to review, and I'm sure that Jackie will probably send you a link to that as well. We are in the process of developing plans for how we're going to handle that data, and we're not at that point just yet, but I know everybody was eager to see what the survey said, so we just gave you a few snippets of information about it. We were very pleased that 81% of our employees did complete the survey.
Sorry.
No problem. 81% of our employees did present the survey, which we feel that was a good amount of information. And then just what I've included today is just very, very general basic information without going into the nuts and bolts of issues, but just the overall, couple of the overall ratings. So overall, how satisfied are you with your current job, and overall, how satisfied are you with the Southern Nevada Health District? And that's broken down by the divisions. All of our most of our information is also broken down by divisions, and then overall employee engagement. So overall, how satisfied are you with your current job at the district? And the vast majority of people are very pleased with their jobs, and we're very excited about the work that they do and the quality that they do. And then how satisfied are you with the Southern Nevada Health District? Again, overall, that was a lesser number, and those are definitely in some of the areas that we'll be looking at. And we recognize that we've had a lot of challenges in the last few years. Employee engagement overall on a scale of 1 to 5, with 5 being high and 1 being not engaged. We're pretty much with the average for industry our size. It came out to an average of about 3.5%. So it's 3.3 in administration, 3.8 community health, environmental health, 3.4, and nursing, 3.6. And then on the next slide is just more of a graph, again, going back to the same question, overall, how satisfied are you with the Southern Nevada Health District? And this is as a whole. And again, approximately 48% of our employees were very satisfied or somewhat satisfied. Another 15% were neutral, which means they were neither satisfied nor dissatisfied. And then we had another 37% were either very dissatisfied or somewhat dissatisfied. And then on our next slide, it was the organization's overall employee satisfaction. It's also compared with other U.S. employees in the SHRM, which is the Society for Human Resource Management database, who provided the survey. And with our employees, again, this is overall job satisfaction. 75% of our employees were satisfied with their jobs. 10% were neutral, either which meant they were neither satisfied nor dissatisfied, and another 15% were dissatisfied. In comparison to other U.S. employees, which showed 70% were satisfied overall with their jobs, 14% were neither satisfied or dissatisfied, and 16% were dissatisfied. And then briefly going to the last slide, which just showed overall what is the reason you continue to work at the Southern Nevada Health District. Again, our benefits were very high. That was one of the highest reasons. The compensation and pay and the meaningfulness of the work that they do. On the low end of that particular scale, the overall culture was rated at one of the lowest amounts, career advancement, followed by flexibility and to balance work life and job security. And the last slide shows what our strengths and opportunities are just in general. We know, again, our strengths are our benefits, the paid time off, the pension, the health care benefits, and the relationship with coworkers. Our opportunities, which is where our challenges are going to be, and some of the items that we will be looking at how we're going to address them, would be overall commitment to professional development, communication between employees and senior management, the health district's financial stability, career development opportunities for learning and professional development, and career advancement opportunities within the organization. So by the next board meeting, we hope to have more detail for you about how we're going to go about start looking at addressing these issues.
Thank you. Do we have any questions? Yes.
What is employee engagement? I guess maybe I missed that part. We measured it, but I'm not sure what
we're measuring. Employee engagement is actually how involved are you in the organization that you're working with, not only in the work you do, the people you do, how you do it. And it is an indicator of satisfaction. Usually employees that are more highly engaged are those that are more satisfied with the work they do. Generally, they do a better job because they are more involved in their work.
And then secondly, maybe for a future presentation, you put in here, actually it's on the same chart where the engagement was, administration, community health, environmental health, nursing. Could we add just how many employees are in each of those particular departments? We see a percentage,
sure.
But you know, 80% of three people is one thing as opposed to 100 people.
Yes, we can definitely put those on future.
Thank you.
I think the divisions range in size from about, is it administration at about 60 or 70, all the way up to environmental health, which is about 140.
About 150, 160.
Yeah. So they're large. Each of the divisions is relatively large.
We currently have no allowance for our continuing ed for our, there's no budget for it, I think.
For continuing, you mean for tuition reimbursement, we do have.
We have two kinds of programs, tuition reimbursement, and again, it has to be related to your job, and that's someone who may need to go back and get some training in a particular area related to their current job. And for continuing education, we do allow that, but it's been minimized over the last couple of years, and in particular, out-of-state education has been minimized. I do almost all of mine online, and I encourage employees to do that too, is to do continuing education. That's where I get the vast majority of my CME that's mm-hmm. required for my medical license. But we do have people that travel, some out of state, mostly grant funded, some 80-10 funded. Last year we were fortunate that NEHA, the National Environmental Health Association, was here, and so we did allow a small stipend to each person who wanted to go to that because it was right here, no travel costs, but we covered part or most of the tuition.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you. Yeah, the numbers would be very key. I think we actually overall had a good turnout, though, response-wise, and while it may sometimes be threatening to management, it should also be a good work tool on how we can always choose to improve, and it's all going to be Absolutely. On how that's approached. But there are some that we have some issues with, and that's where the brainstorming and the really looking at the cultural changes that need to come into play on that. I believe there was a comment section, too, so will we be able to see those comment sections as well at some point?
What we're doing with that is we really haven't started to look at that now.
Yeah, it's early. I know this is very preliminary, but I personally would like to see that because in the old days when I was president of the teachers union, when I would get a complaint about an administration at a school, it was not for me to judge. So we would do a confidential survey. Sometimes in the verbiage, it helps you drive down and helps
sure.
that management be better if you can do it in a non-adversarial role. And I think sometimes it's not just the little I can hit number one or two, but really looking at how people took the time to write something down. So I would hope that at some point we have
right.
access to that.
In the summary of it, there were, I don't even remember how many comments, but about two-thirds in this executive summary told us that two-thirds of those comments were positive. You can predict by looking at the results that Ms. Oakley has given to you, that's pay, benefits, and so on. About one-third of the comments were negative, and that's where we need to go through and try to see what the patterns are and what they mean.
Sure, because if you look at administration, 50% were overall satisfied. Community health, 57. Environmental
sure.
health, 31. Nursing,
sure.
61. But what does that then translate
exactly.
to? And I think overall we try to pay our people pretty well. I think the union does a good job on that, and that should always be an incentive to stay at a job. But then there's that internal part of wanting to do the best that you can because
sure.
of the type of business. And we forget sometimes in the health district we have so many more diplomaed people, I guess, folks mm-hmm. with more certifications in that part. And there's an expectation
sure.
there that you not only compensate them well, but there's a career ladder opportunity, some things along those lines. So I think I appreciate that we did this. I think it's initial, very early in the stages, but I do think we have some issues to work on. So
yeah. The actual survey that was posted on the intranet is about 59 pages right now of results. And there's more. There's a lot of data to review. So hopefully by next month we'll be in a much better position to discuss it, and we'll have a plan. And we do look at it as a tool, or one tool that we can use to kind of identify and address what some of the issues are that we want to put most of our emphasis on in the coming
And I believe
years.
You have a labor management committee, correct?
We do.
And so that would be a good resource, I would think, to start to work through, because I would not want to see management just coming up with a plan of action. This is an opportunity to engage everybody, and so I would hope that would be part of what we look
Actually,
at.
I'd be looking at a multidisciplinary tool, not just including just the union group, but various other groups within the organization at different levels. You want to volunteer?
Absolutely.
Great. Thank you.
I have time on my
hands right now. If I may, just sort of subjectively, what we presented to you today is better than what I thought it would be. I think probably, I see you shaking your head, it is better than what I thought it would be, given the variety and many and significant changes that we've been through over the last 2 years. To me, that's heartening, but indeed we always can improve. That's the reason to do this and to see, measure over time what that approval rating is and what those comments are so that we can see that whatever changes we decide to implement actually make a difference in people's lives. We've already implemented several, as you know, an employee engagement group that is, again, management, union, non-union, that is looking at events. You know, we had something on St. Patrick's Day where, of course, everyone is Irish, and other kinds of events. And we had the one holiday event that was well attended, everyone liked, that we'll continue to do that. We now have fundraisers going to raise funds for other employee events, and I think the employees who are engaged with that are happy with the way that's going, but that's not every employee.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
There are two other things that I wanted to talk about. One is we've talked a lot about budget deficits over the last couple of years, and I wanted to let you know we don't have a formal budget update for you because you passed the budget last month, but we hoped to get several hundred thousand dollars in additional $80-$10 from the 3.5 cents per 100, and what we actually got was $71,000. Only, so that's hardly enough to do much with, but it will help to make a small dent in our outgoing year's budget deficits, and that's how we plan to apply it. We have had a lot of budget issues that we've been trying to address, and if you look at the first page called monthly overtime pay, I think that is in front of you. In the blue is 2 years ago by dates. I think it ends in March. Red is 1 year ago, and green is the last 12 months. And what you'll see in overtime pay is a better management of that, so that not every month shows a decline. And you see in later in the months of January, February, and March of last year, it was lower than what it was this year. But again, look at the blue, red, green under every month for those 3 years, and you'll see a pretty dramatic reduction in overtime. Part of that this year and ongoing will be the changes in the union contract that allows a little bit more flexibility in the hours that employees work. If you look at standby duty pay, which is what we were paying people to be just on standby duty to be able to answer the phones. We've eliminated much, if not most, of that. And again, it's the same color scheme. 2 years ago is blue, 1 year ago is red, and this year, over the last 12 months, not fully this fiscal year or calendar year, you see the decline in that. Finally, in standby overtime pay, you'll see a dramatic decrease in that as well. Now, there are always unintended consequences, and that's what you see on the final page, and you see that the monthly callback pay has increased, especially in March and February, actually this year, when we implemented some changes to have supervisors do the on-call calls and bringing people back in then to respond to pools or restaurants is where we now see that overtime pay. And we're developing guidelines by which a supervisor or a manager should be able to call someone back in order to do something after hours. So we'll continue to watch that. This is just something I wanted to do for you, considering the fact that our budget has been in not good shape and is coming under better shape. The other issue that I had is in my report, and it's about Environmental Health contacting us from the state to talk about taking over some of their duties here in this county. You may recall that I think it was 2 years ago during the legislature, it might have been 4 years ago now, that with the budget deficits, the state, the legislature said that all of the services that are done in the county by the State Health Division, any county, have to be subsidized by that county. And currently, the County of Clark provides $40,000 just to environmental health in order for them to do their inspections that they have to do in our county. Those inspections are at state facilities, so it's the universities, community colleges, the hospitals that they have, and others. And I'm trying to remember what Joe Pollack wrote me about, but there are about 142 restaurants and six pools and a couple of other things. And so we have been looking at what can we do to help the state, since they had a person who is retiring, and it is likely that we will be taking over those state facilities for them. That helps them, and I think it helps us, strengthens us in the long run as well. And we will be charging the state facilities whatever we charge everyone else. So there, the way we have looked at it actuarially is that we will about break even. I do have a call in to Don to talk to him about the money that they may be able to save. I don't think he's going to have an issue. I don't think the two commissioners are here would have an issue with us taking over those facilities either. We have had, Joe did talk to us about the one FTE who was here, spends 0.7 of his time in Clark County, 0.3 in Nye County, and we have had some discussions, but we're not even close to having further discussions about that, what it would mean for us actuarially. I think that we could probably do Pahrump for cheaper than we can do Mesquite and Boulder City, since it's kind of closer than those two, but that doesn't mean that we're going to do it, and you'll be fully informed along the way. And by the way, these facilities here in Clark County fall under our regulations, our fee schedule. So everyone will be treated the same. Do you all have any questions about either of those or anything else in my report? The last thing, well, I think under the CHO report would be the building update. And Andy, do you want to? Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Contained within your packet, and as Jackie's bringing up, is the work that's been being done over the course of the past month on the building itself, the site, as you see presented right now. And then as we go on in these slides, we've been looking at various interior design treatments for the building. We're looking at, we have applied to the city for additional redevelopment funds, which will enable us to enhance what we're doing both on the outside and the inside of the building, both in the large building, the 278 building, as well as the four smaller shops, the 280 buildings, as we're calling them. This is a representation of what we're looking at for the exterior of the building as you look at it. And as we go on in our slides, some of the different treatments that we're looking at, certainly enhancing the parking lot and the physical appearance from the outside, as well as the inside. On the lower left, you see the depiction of what would be the front reception area for the district. And immediately behind that, by the way, behind the SNHD that you see on that wall is the what we're calling the boardroom, the large administrative conference room, which would be replacing this room. And next one, Jackie, I think we have also one of the things that we're really trying to pay attention to, and hopefully with these additional dollars that we are going to get from the city, will enable us to be able to bring in natural light. At this particular point, that building has absolutely no exterior lighting whatsoever. There's no windows or doors. And what we're looking at is solar tubes and or ceiling, good grief, ceiling lights. Skylights. Skylights. We're also looking at different ways of treating the interior of the building. We have a very tall ceiling, and in the lower right-hand side, you can see the more modernistic approach to having an open ceiling with our ductwork. But these various treatments are being explored. The other thing that's really important about what we're doing now is that, as you know, with an existing building, you never know what you have until you really get into it. So between the construction manager and the architect, there's been a lot of work being done on investigating the utilities, particularly underground within the building, so that we know where the ducts and the wiring go within the building. We have done the initial round of budgeting, and we really have asked everybody to get out sharp pencils, because we are quite a bit off on our budget at this point, but we're going through that, and that's the value of having a construction manager at risk, is that the value engineering that goes into the entire project. We also have put in the demolition permit that was submitted on the 20th, and hopefully by the end of May we'll see actual work beginning. Also, the building permit is due to be submitted in early May, and that's about it. Any questions? Thank you.
Any questions? Comments? Thank you.
Two other things to add is that we are essentially done with the community health assessment, and we'll be within the next month or so opening up, developing the community health improvement plan subcommittee. I believe all of you are on my list to be invited to participate in that, as well as community members throughout the valley. And I think that we're planning on next month having the major themes that have come out of the community health assessment to present to you, and I'm excited about this. And again, you know, I'm now older, as I get every day, and have I told you about that we're part of the 28 cities, 28 counties health coalition? I have?
Somehow or other I heard it.
Okay, so real briefly, we were invited by NACHO to participate as one of the 28 largest health jurisdictions in the nation. We are. So we're actually probably around 15, and they have had 20, but we've been invited along with my hometown of Kansas City, where there is the best barbecue in the world, and Sacramento, Alameda County, Minneapolis, and others. And this will revitalize this committee. They look at big city issues. Of course, we have Frontier right here in our own county, and we won't forget that, but it does allow us to engage much more broadly on the national scale and represent our state on our own state issues as well. So I'm really excited about that and about what that can mean for us as a jurisdiction, and in the long run perhaps some additional reimbursements from our health from CDC, HRSA, and other funding agencies. Do you have any questions about any of that? Then the brief legislative agenda is that everything that's been going through the Senate has gone through the Senate. The one bill that we opposed would have changed the structure and function of both the board and the health district. And I hope Jennifer is still here in case I forget something, but it would decrease the number of appointed members from 6 to 3. It would eliminate the alternates from sitting on the board. I believe it still changes the quorum, but that may have been left over from the assembly bill. They took that out. What that would have been is that whoever showed up is a quorum, and so you just need a majority of those. So if only 3 of you showed up and 2 of you voted for an item. So that's not how anyone functions here. And then under this bill, there would be a district officer who would be above the chief health officer and would add on to the costs of us, and would have, could be me if you chose to put me up there. I'm qualified to be in that position, but it would change whether a physician was the leader of this health district from that point on. And there is one other. Oh, it does add an advisory board, so the 3 of you who would be taken off of this board would be joined by representatives from the jurisdictions as an advisory board. Personally, that's going to, I'll tell you, that's going to double our work to have to care and feed for an advisory board that could be many people long. So I'm personally against that, but if you all are for it, I'll change my position on any of these. But that would certainly add to the amount of time that we spend doing this kind of work on a monthly basis. Is that it?
Okay, thank you.
The other things I think we have yet to see what will happen with them. We're still looking at e-cigarettes, age restrictions of buying them. and a variety of other things. There, it did pass the Senate to have a pickling bill that we and every other health jurisdiction in the United States would be opposed to. As you may have seen, I think it was just yesterday or the day before, over the weekend there was a botulism exposure. We're not quite sure what that was due to. One person died, but doing home canning is generally the cause of that, and so we are opposed to that on public health grounds. I think that's it, sir.
All right. Thank you very much. Next is the informational items, which you have for your own perusal, and then we'll move to the final public comment period. Anyone wishing to speak? All right. Well, Bruce, did you do your evaluations? Evaluate each board member? Do you want to speak now?
I do have a question for him, though. What is in the current legislature that will be the state dance form? They're going to be voting on what the official state dance will be.
A square dance.
And I'll tell you that I'm an avid square dancer, so that may be a hint.
What happened to pole dancing?
Okay.
I think he's a little young to know about that form of dance. Okay.
All right, Tim, your evaluation is going to be posted on Facebook.
And even I'm embarrassed.
I thought it was the local.
All right. Meeting adjourned. Thank you. Did you?